This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Now, Frank here, he's got his own billiard room.
Yes, what do you call it, Kramer?
Billiard room, no.
The bank. The billiard? Not the billiards. It was... Come on, Everett. Come on. We call it the place.
The place to be, yes.
It's the place to be.
Then I shall leave.
Place to Be Nation, Scott Criscola and Justin Rosero. This is the Place to Be podcast.
To do worse than Josh Richer.
Nation. Welcome to another great episode of the one and only Place to Be podcast. I am your co-host, Justin Rosero, coming to you live here on this Monday evening, as is usual, inside the mothership. And of course, joining me, as always, my PIC, Mr. Scott Criscola. Scott, how are you?
Good evening, JR. Good evening, Place to Be Nation. Welcome to episode 458 of the Gold Standard, the continuously running episodic Gold Standard. JR, how's it going?
Not bad. You know, weekend.
Heard an interesting story today. I hadn't been on Facebook the last couple of days, and the Silverback told me something about a runaway swing, the bench swing today. Something happened?
Yeah, it was last night. It was kind of I don't know what happened, honestly. My dad was sitting on the swing. I don't know. My daughter was, like, pushing it up, and he went to sit on it while she was, like, pushing it up, and somehow the whole thing tipped backwards, and he went down, and he went backwards with it. So it was quite the scene last night.
Oh, God. Egads. Well, yeah. Glad everyone's all right.
So, yeah. Good. Glad. How are you? Right.
I'm well. It is. We're here into the dog days of August, a couple weeks till Brooklyn for the third year in a row, a little group going. And, yeah, we'll talk about that next week on our next episode of The Main Event, full-blown SummerSlam preview next week.
Yeah, of course. New Main Event dropped last week. It was you and...
Nate and our man, Mr. Brandon Howard.
That's right, making his main event debut. How did you enjoy talking to Brandon?
Oh, Brandon's fantastic. We were talking about the network and talent and other promotions making an effect financially on the network and all the rumors about, you know, where they're buying more stuff and things like that. So, you know, why original programming got cut back in favor of the archive stuff. So if you haven't had a chance to listen to episode 81 of The Main Event, please do. It's very, very good. The Godfather, Nate Milton, and I talked a little WWE, but this coming next week, episode 82, will be the SummerSlam preview. So we'll have a full boat. We'll preview TakeOver and, of course, SummerSlam. And actually, JR, which we mentioned on Main Event, for the first time in the three-year run of being in Brooklyn, they're actually going to extend it a fourth day because SmackDown Live is actually going to be at Barclays as well.
Oh, jeez. Four days of that.
Full-blown 4 days.
Yeah. And by the way, it's Nate Milden, as some idiots may say. And speaking of those idiots.
Only one person says Milden. You know who it is.
And it's his six-year anniversary today. That was kind of the first big event in Place to Be podcast history. It was the Rotella wedding year. 6 years ago today, we were out in that castle in Connecticut on that magical evening.
That's right. Passing out free prime rib and... We finished the whiskey, and I think we emptied the bar, actually.
Yeah, it was quite the show.
We had our exceptional live performance with all the bridesmaids doing figure eights with the candles. It was an evening to remember, I have to say.
It was a weekend.
Quite well done.
Weekend forgotten that I like to remember
Speaking of an evening to remember, I always remember my evenings with this guy. Who do we have? Mr. Nelson, of course, not with us this evening because this is not a house show. This is... an event that is quite large. So we bring in the man who's always large and in charge, JR, and that is...
Mr. J. Arsenio D'Amato. Johnny, how are you?
Good evening, guys. Thanks a lot. Sorry to be intruding on Kelly's home turf of Toronto.
Well, you know how it is. You get buried in your hometown. So Kelly's not allowed on when they're actually in his hometown, when he's away. John,
and you figure, Johnny, he's on for every one of your episodes. He's always infringing because he's always at the garden.
That's
so
right.
He pretty much infringes on your turf every almost every month. So,
John, how are you?
It's good to have you on tonight, John.
Yeah,
beautiful. I pounded a couple juice boxes for some energy, and I'm ready to go. We're gonna party like it's 1986.
Very good. Well, we're gonna get all fired up. Philly's coming before you know it. Tickets are all in. Payments are out. Right, you're good to go, and we've got our seats Be excited? Ready to go for the weekend?
Gotta get through. Yeah, we gotta get through SummerSlam first, one thing at a time.
I'm ready through SummerSlam. Yep. I'm not going. I'm gonna be watching on my couch. Cowboy Senior is coming down to watch that show with us. By the way, he's off the next.
Oh, that's outstanding.
Yeah, looking forward to it.
Outstanding. Yeah,
be a good time. While you guys are sitting amongst the assholes, booing belts and whatever else is going on in Brooklyn. I always sit with the assholes here, like Dan McGinn. So it'll be fun.
Oh, he'll be quite comfy in his seat.
He won't be booing the bell. He'll just be moping about it. But yes, we'll be here. But anyway, yes, Philly will be here before we know. It'll be a good time. All right, why don't we dive into tonight's topic?
Yeah, let's do this. Tonight, because Mr. D'Amato was here, that of course means a huge wrestling extravaganza. In fact, it is an event. It is the big event. Kind of a precursor, if you will, to what would happen 2 years later when we have our inaugural actual SummerSlam. This was almost like a SummerSlam test run of sorts. So let's just jump in. Your date is August 28th, 1986. So JR, about 3 days after our house show that we did last week, live from CNE Stadium in Toronto, Ontario, home of the Mr. Nelson's beloved Toronto Blue Jays. We'll talk a little baseball later on. Surprisingly, I thought it was surprisingly, but as we were talking about it today, I guess not a big deal because WWE didn't think of things like this back then yet. But there was another show going on this night, and actually it was pseudo-loaded.
Yeah.
The other venue was Kemper Arena in Kansas City, so actually a pretty halfway decent venue. They weren't in the middle of nowhere. They were in a pretty high-profile place. Here's your card. The first match, JR, is two guys that were popular in other promotions, but we'll talk about later on down the line. The Ugandan Giant and one half of the PYTs. I'll just leave that at that. We'll talk about debuts when they come to the Garden. The Haiti Kid defeated Butch Cassidy right there in D'Amato's wheelhouse right there. Bob Orton Jr. defeating the Flying High Corporal Kirshner. Even though he wasn't on TV, he was probably still flying high. The Fabulous Moolah.
That's Bob Orton.
Orton, yes. Orton and Nildin. Your women's champion, the Fabulous Moolah, successfully defended the ladies' championship against Princess Jasmine. Isn't that a Disney character? the Hart Foundation.
It was. Well, Aladdin had been created yet, though, so it wouldn't have been a Disney character yet. So maybe they stole it from the show. Maybe someone from some Disney executive was in the house and buried it deep in their mind for Aladdin eventually. I don't think the story of Aladdin was based on anything, right? I think that was an original movie. I don't know. It was Jordan Knox when we need him.
Well, Aladdin. The Hart Foundation defeated the new U.S. Express. Your Intercontinental Champion, the Macho Man Randy Savage, defeated George the Animal Steel by DQ. So, JR, be pleased to know we don't have to watch that match this evening. And your main event, your World Wrestling Federation Tag Team Champions, the British Bulldogs, defeated the Foreign Legion of Nikolai Volkoff and the Iron Sheik. So the other two belts were in the other building. So only the big belt. Do we have this evening in Toronto?
I was watching doing some prep work for this week's Letters from Sender Stage.
Editors.
And part of it included an amazing French-Canadians match. And Chris Cruz actually calls them the Foreign Legion. It was the amazing French-Canadians and Colonel Rob Parker calls them the Foreign Legion, which made me laugh. So there you go. Kelly actually weighed in just to give us some insight because, like you mentioned, you thought it was kind of weird that they had two shows on this night, that the belts weren't all there. But he said leading up to it, the big event wasn't considered a big show like we think of it. It was just a special outdoor show that caught fire the last couple of weeks and ticket sales went through the roof. They initially anticipated maybe around 25,000, but there was no precedent because no wrestling show had ever legitimately drew 40,000 fans, let alone 65,000. I think the decision to tape it was also a last-second call when they realized how large the crowd is going to be. But really, it's just another night on the road, not an all-hands-on-deck show like a WrestleMania.
Okay. Makes sense, I guess. They hadn't really thought about that, promoting that way. But obviously, they would very much so as time progresses. All right. There is the rest of our report. And are we ready to dive right in? Anything else we got, JR?
No, I think we're good to go. It's, of course, like
all
you
right,
said.
So let's hop in.
Big show in Toronto. Anything you want to headline?
Your attendance. Let me double check. Let's see. According to Graham, the official count, of course, Gorilla, your announcers, by the way, Gorilla Monsoon. Interesting trio here that we're gonna highlight as the show progresses. Gorilla Monsoon, Luscious Johnny Valiant, and the Big Cat Ernie Ladd. which was an interesting trio. Mm-hmm. They kept saying over 70,000, but according to Mr. Cawthon, the paid attendance was 61,470. They kept saying 64,000 as well. So apparently it was a sellout. But of course, you know, Gorilla was inflating it a bit to over 70, but it looked like a huge crowd. That there was no doubt of whenever they did like wide shots. Did the place look kind of dark to you though? Like it wasn't as lit as it should have been? Or do you think that was just the cameras? Did it seem dark to you?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's just the way. I mean, it's probably hard to light it up, the baseball stadium. I mean, they didn't really have, like, the lighting rigs and stuff that they could up in that, you know, like they do today. So, I mean, they're pretty much just going off the baseball stadium lights, right, at that point? Or whatever that place was, the exhibition.
Yeah, well, no, it was a multifaceted, you know, kind of like Riverfront or Busch or those kind of places, because the Blue Jays play there and the Argos play there as well.
So. Yeah, but if you look at it, it's literally just the... I mean, it's literally just the stadium lighting, so it's nothing else. So, yeah, I mean, I think that's probably why.
Mm, okay, just checking. All right, so there's your broadcast team, which I'm going to talk about a lot tonight because it was a very unique dynamic with these three guys.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and we'll have some thoughts on some of our feedback that we'll read at the end of the night. Zeroes in on what happened with them. So, all right, yeah. So, fun idea here with a big show inside of a large stadium, and the crowd, like Kelly mentioned, ended up being much larger than maybe they initially anticipated. Our opener is the Funk Brothers, that is Haas and Jimmy Jack, taking on the Killer Bees. This would actually, I think, be about it, right? Didn't we? I think we talked about this with Kelly on a couple of shows ago, right? Was this Haas's, or we saw that he leaked into like September a little bit, right?
I think he leaked into September a little bit, yeah. But this is the last time like he's on a big TV special.
And it's the last time we're going to talk about him, I think. So we can definitely mention that at the end. Jimmy Hart leads out the Funks for the opener. They continue to be pretty relevant despite the downgrade. The Bees jog out next, and this should be, I thought, a fun match on paper. A good choice for the opener. Gorilla talks about the hot tag division as Johnny V says it won't be long before the Dream Team is back on top. Gorilla says Dirty F has broken all attendance records for the stadium. Haas and Blair start off with Blair hot off the bell, running through both Funks and sending them scurrying to regroup. We reset with Haas catching Blair with a knee to the gut and trapping him in the corner, but Blair punches out of trouble and the Funks again regroup. Jimmy Jack comes in and gets more of the same as Blair's us all over until he bails. Brunzel tags in and Ladd compliments the Funk strategy and patience as Haas tags back in, lands a forearm, but Brunzel comes in with a crossbody for two before going to work on the arm. The Bees are quick tagging and focusing on the arm of Haas. Haas escapes, so Jimmy Jack walks into an armbar, leading to the Bees controlling the action again. Brunzel tags in and gets a sleeper, but Haas breaks free and knocks Brunzel outside, where Jimmy Jack meets him on the with a slam on the floor and spikes him into the apron. Back inside, Jimmy Jack drops Brunzel across the top rope with a hot shot, and it's a forearm off the middle rope for two. Haas tags in and clubs away and has a nice vertical suplex for a near fall. Brunzel comes back with a drop kick and makes the tag, but the ref didn't see it, so the Funks double team and shove Brunzel to the floor, and then Haas levels Blair too. As the Bees are on the floor, they put on their masks, and Johnny V asks if they're going to go pull a bank job. Blair comes in and clean towels on both guys before grabbing an abdominal stretch on Haas. Jimmy Jack makes a save, but the Bees swap behind the ref's back to a pop. Brunzel cradles Jimmy Jack for the win. Johnny V hated that, and the crowd liked it, though. Fun little opener. Mm-hmm. I thought the pacing was pretty good. Good work by all four men. Jimmy Jack has improved, I thought, during the stretch, just working with Haas, and they've remained a pretty good team. But they're kind of just finding their footing, and it ends because, like we said, Haas is on his way out the door. So the Bees nab a nice win on a big card. I went 2 stars for this. Let's talk about the match itself, and then we can talk about Haas on his way out the door, Scott.
Okay. Your official match time is 6:53, so kind of a good little sprint there.
Mm-hmm.
I gave it a star and a half, slightly less than you. I liked it. I wasn't the greatest thing on the planet, but it was a solid little match. Killer Bees doing the whole mask gimmick. But what I liked about the announcers, and they do this a lot, Ernie Ladd was just utterly focused on analysis. He wanted to analyze the matches, analyze the heels, you know, talk about what's going on in the ring. And Gorilla and Johnny are just kind of doing their usual, you know, like the byplay that, you know, Gorilla and Bobby would do or Gorilla and Jesse would do. And Ernie was almost like doing his own, like he was announcing his own show. It was very strange. And that would be a common theme between the three of them as the night progressed. And it was pretty unique. It led to some fun spots, a little different than we would have at our normal MSG shows. But I liked the match. It was fine. I mean, it wasn't anything great. I'm still not the biggest Jimmy Jack Funk fan.
No, he's not a good. But I mean, I think he's slightly improved working with Haas. Like from when we first saw him, he actually seems to kind of be able to piece shit together at this point now. Whereas he seemed lost those first few matches.
Yeah, no, he was a little – he's getting slightly better, and unfortunately he's obviously going to lose his help. So God only knows what happens from this point forward. And the Bees are on a roll. I mean, they're kind of in their wheelhouse stretch here where, I mean, sadly, you know, because babyfaces are tag champions right now, they may not – by the time they get a title shot, you know, they may be kind of pushed down the ladder depending on how the tag division shapes up for the next year. But the Bees are looking good. They have great chemistry. And they made the match better. So I liked it, but I said it was okay. I didn't like it as much as you did, but it was, you know, it was serviceable for a good opener. Crowd was a little flat, and it could be flat in spots I didn't expect them to be. But also, it's, you know, it's hard to gauge 64,000 people. But as we would see later on in the night, you can hear them when they want to cheer. Mm. So, but I thought the match was fine. And I'll miss Haas, but, you know, I mean, you know, Dory Funk's not a spring chicken, but he was a good, workable guy who can do decent stuff in the ring and help out guys that are fairly terrible. But it'll be tough not to see him around anymore. What'd you think, Johnny?
The first thing that sticks out, you guys mentioned the commentary. For me, it's a big step down from Jesse.
And
later on. Yes, definitely. They should have just stuck with Lloyd. I guess they felt like they had to do something special for the crowd, so they went a little outside the box. But it didn't work for me. Johnny V was just a low rate, as we'll see later in the year when the Brain steps in, and Johnny V just doesn't cut it for me. He's like too focused on his comedy routines, which ironically he would later be like a stand up comic experiment, and you know he did a little stand up comedy, but he hit on like 1 out of 5 like one liners for me. It was definitely not as good. And it was a step down. And like you said, Scott, I noticed the same thing. Ernie, the V and Gorilla would be like going at it, you know, with their little arguments, their little sticky arguments. And Ernie was you know, saying, oh, you know, he's holding that headlock. He's got it in tight. He would just be ignoring their little back and forth. So it was a weird dynamic, and it didn't really work for him.
It gets weirder. It definitely gets weirder, too, as the night goes on with him. Mm-hmm. We'll talk about it later, but he definitely like stops caring at some point throughout the year.
But as far as the match itself, I'm going to miss Haas. He's just such an old pro in these tag teams. He's just like tag wrestling 101 with the double teams, and he's always in the right spot distracting the ref. I love Haas. His little run here is underrated. It's a little short run, and he could do tag teams. I could watch him in tag teams all day, man. Everything was good for him. And you guys noticed that like the sound really picks up on the crowd. The mics are really close to the ring, and Jimmy Hart's megaphone, him chanting on, it really came through loud as he was cheering on his guys. So I picked that up on as far as the sound goes. But overall, I give it 2 stars like you, J.R.
Yeah, it was a fine opener. And like you said, definitely marred by the commentary that gets worse and worse as it goes on. I'll miss Haas, too. I've really come to enjoy him in these tag matches. Like, he's balanced out Jimmy Jack quite a bit when Jimmy Jack sucks. Like, Haas just gets in, and he's really good and fun to watch. And it really is too bad that Terry left, because I think they could have been a pretty good team throughout, even just through the summer, if they got some matches in with the Bulldogs and just got more of a push. I would say, like, it would have been cool if they gave Haas a bit of a singles run, but it just I don't think he just would have went anywhere. Like, you kind of have Harley Race fulfilling the ugly old man role, you know, like legend, but just the look wise, like, it just, they weren't going to seriously get behind Dory Funk at this point. So
tag teams would have been perfect for him. Yeah, him and Terry versus some Bulldogs. So it's too bad we didn't get some of those matches. That would have been.
I agree.
That would have been really good. So there you have it. There's our opener. Scott.
Yeah, one comment quick before we move on, and we were talking about the lighting, and Johnny, you were talking about the audio, and it's probably, I mean, when was the last time they did like the WWF did like a legit big outdoor show? I guess in Showdown at Shea? I mean, has it been 6 years since they've probably had like a moderately decent outdoor show? Not talking like the state fairs and, you know, the Melody Tent and the, you know, Warwick Music Theater or whatever. I'm talking about like this, like a legit. So I wonder, Johnny, and if they were maybe like experimenting with outdoor, I don't say audio visual, but, you know, things like lighting and you know, kind of having some more realism in the ring, because they could kind of adjust because they need more people to hear it. I'm just curious, because I don't really remember. Maybe we can go through Graham's site somewhere down the line, but I don't remember any bigger shows outdoors since Showdown at Shea, right? I don't think so.
I think that this is all just last minute. I think they realized that they were gonna the main event. It was so hot that it couldn't handle the Maple Leaf Gardens, and this was all last minute, so they were able to sell more tickets outside. And as you notice, it's called the big event, but they don't talk about like, oh, this is the big event. Welcome to the big event. That was kind of like tacked on after. And as you guys see, I sent you guys with the advertising. There really wasn't it wasn't a big event. It's not like, oh, SummerSlam, where they mentioned it 100 times and, you know, Survivor Series. So this is all just kind of done on the fly.
Mm. Okay. Yeah.
Because it screams it 100%, John. Like you're 100% right. I mean, you can tell that they really weren't promoting it as like a huge special summertime, you know, what eventually becomes SummerSlam type of show. It was just a local show for Toronto. And, you know, Jack Tunney gets talked to later about how proud he is. So I'm sure he played a big role in pushing to have like a big show in Toronto or something like that. So I think it was. Yeah, I don't think it was supposed to be anything special. I think you nailed it.
And they had the same card running that you mentioned the other night with three titles on the line, so they didn't have to stack this because they were able to sell enough tickets on this one based on the main event. So
right. No, you're right. Absolutely. All right, we can move on.
Okay, let's move on.
What do we got next up?
Well, Mean Gene, he's outside the ring chatting with Mr. Fuji, who issues warnings to King Tonga, saying he'll be paying his dues. Morocco comes in and ends the interview and heads to the ring. And our next match is a big one here to pay off the issue that started all the way back early in 1986 between King Tonga and Magnificent Morocco. I think, was that February, that whole thing, Scott? It feels like it was a while ago, wasn't it? Yeah, it was pre-2 because we talked about it, how they could have taken advantage of 2 when Tonga saved when Morocco's beating up Steamboat and then Tonga ends up being in his corner. So yeah, take a look at that while I'm reading through. But good elevation point for Tonga. Right as Morocco slipping down the card, kind of two ships passing in the night. Gorilla tells us Tonga now wants to be known as Haku, his native name. Johnny V says it's Achu, he calls them. Morocco's cutoff t-shirt, by the way, also never gets old. We start, well, actually, let's pause real quick. What did you guys think of the Haku name switch? Was it? I mean, we'll see why, you know, at our next show, basically, because of the direction they go with Haku. But did you think it was an upgrade for a name, John?
About the same. It doesn't do much for me as far as King Tonga Haku. It doesn't at this stage. It does nothing for me at this stage. But later on, when it gets to the Rumble and Vince's famous Haku, but not right now.
I think it's like two reasons, you know. And I guess, man, we can talk about it now, I guess. But I think one reason is because of the direction they were taking him, and, you know, who his new teammate was going to be, formally used the name Tonga as well, and they kind of eliminated from both names. But also, I'm guessing, partially because Harley Race is becoming the king after winning King of the Ring. So maybe they don't want to have two kings, King Harley Race and King Tonga. I'm guessing that's part of it as well.
I think that makes sense. I agree with that.
And that's ironically, good reasoning. And ironically, what would happen if you...
I know, yeah, right.
you can't make it up.
Haku. But I also think Haku's like a easier name to say, quicker name, shorter name.
Yeah.
You know, announcers could just say Haku, Haku. You know, it's easier.
Or Hachu, Hachu,
Hachu, Hachu, Hachu, Hachu. But I think the whole Harley thing is a good...
I'm guessing that's part of it, yeah.
Yeah.
All right, so we start with some stalling and feeling out as V says Haku is in awe of what's going on. Gorilla talks about his ligament strength, as always. Haku starts hot with some hip tosses and a scoop slams. Gorilla says his Polynesian blood is running hot tonight. Morocco rolls out to regroup, comes back in, and gets dropkicked right back to the floor. The announcers keep mixing up Haku's name, basically halftime calling him Tonga, half the time calling him Haku. Johnny V's just making fun of the name the whole time. Haku works the arm until Morocco catches him with a hard clothesline and goes to work. Morocco slams Haku but misses a pair of elbow drops, and Haku regains control of the arm vigorously. Ladd is, I thought, pretty good here early on, at least in this match, where he's breaking down the psychology, while Gorilla's just making fun of Fuji and V is mocking Haku's name. And like you said, John, Ladd is like trying to actually call the match, and I'm guessing this is why he starts to get annoyed, but... So he's calling it straight. Gorilla is just fucking around. Johnny V is doing his routine. V says you have to be devious if you want to hang with Morocco. The Magnificent One then takes control after Fuji hooks Haku's foot. Haku ends up on the floor, and Fuji smacks him in the neck and the gut with the cane. Morocco slams Haku back in the ring and then goes to a nerve hold. Morocco releases and slams Haku and then catches him with the Asian spike off the middle rope. I'm sorry, the Asiatic spike off the middle rope before going back to the nerve hold. Morocco clubs away and back to the nerve again as Gorilla says Fuji has taught him all of the martial arts. Each and every single one of the martial arts has been taught by Fuji to Morocco, apparently. Haku chops his way free and drop kicks Morocco to the corner, misses a charge. Morocco kicks away and then starts to work the leg, wrapping it around the post and getting a shin breaker. Keeps targeting the leg until he grabs a figure four, but Haku works out. Morocco maintains control and heads up top, but Haku catches him and slams him off and then chops away. Haku gets a cross body block, but we hit the time limit draw before the pin. Just kind of there, I guess, technically fine, but no real hot stretch behind it. The draw felt like it came out of nowhere. Like, we didn't get the usual face shine building up to it. It just kind of happened. I don't think we really needed a long draw on the show when you look at how many matches we had and how long this thing goes. Like, I don't think we needed a fucking 20-minute match with these guys. Nothing gets settled. Haku moves on to other things. Morocco's aimless. I think Haku should just went over here. Like, Morocco's not going to get hurt by losing. They could have done a flash pin, a sunset flip or something where he catches him off guard after a collision with Fuji. Anything like that. This finish just felt kind of unneeded with the two of them. So, you know, Haku's on to bigger and better things. But I was expecting a little bit more given the build around this. So, what'd you think of this, John?
For mostly the PWO guys in the anti-Morocco hating club, this is their match that they'll show. To just whether you like them or not, this is just classic Morocco heel work. With his stalling and taking forever to get into the ring and egging on the crowd and spitting and just blowing snot rockets and with the long rest holds. This is just, you know, plotting Morocco that you know, that all the haters will show, say will point to this match and say this is why Morocco sucks. But I mean, he's had better, but yeah, overall, I only give the match a star. It was, I guess it was one of those time fillers that they needed to kill some time, but it wasn't much, and for lack of a finish, yeah, it wasn't a star, and it was even Steven, doesn't really put anybody over, and it doesn't really bury anybody, so.
Especially with Haku, you know, starting to get a push off of the show and where he's headed, they should just give him the win. This does nothing for anybody. What do you think, Scott?
Yeah, before we get to my comments, we look back. It was February 86 house show was the Steamboat Morocco match, and that was where the save happened. And then they actually wrestled on the March 86 house show, Tonga and Morocco. And didn't they wrestle one more time? Was it June?
Maybe.
They wrestled one more time. Let me look here. Morocco, GYD. Thank you. I'm going to keep looking. I could have sworn they wrestled one more time. But in any event, I gave this match a half star. I'm sorry. I gave it a star and a half. I mean, I like Morocco. He just, even the stalling entertains me. It's just a personal preference. I think it's funny. I mean, it's obvious that he probably thinks deep down that he's kind of getting pushed down the ladder a little bit as other guys are coming in terms of the heels. We're going to see some better heels later on down the line. So he probably deep down is thinking, you know, kind of like Tony Atlas at the house show last week. Yeah, fuck this. I'm just going to fuck around my way through this match. I'd like to know, I don't really understand why they got 20 minutes. If you're going to give any match a draw on this show, I probably wouldn't have given it to them.
Maybe Haku, but not Morocco at this point.
Yeah. But if you were going to give a match if it was a match on this card that you would give the draw to, I wouldn't have given it to this one. There's a couple other better ones. But, I mean, the announcing, as you said, this is where it really gets bad. It's literally like Gorilla and Bob, Johnny V are having their stupid back and forth, and then Ernie Ladd's like, well, Morocco doing his excellent heel, like, as if they're not even there.
No,
and
no,
it does
no.
get worse as you go along. I like the name Haku. I do. I will say that. I thought they could get a better match here, even with the 20 minutes, because I felt like they did have decent chemistry. When they had those couple guard matches, and they didn't. Maybe it was the length, but I thought maybe we could have expected more and didn't get it. I'm surprised Morocco did dominate the action, though. I mean, you know, obviously heel dictation's one thing, but I mean, I feel like he was dictating the match like for 16 of these 20 minutes. And I thought that was, you know, the match could have been better if they did a little more even Steven. Because you could have had Haku work Morocco over on moves, and that would have eaten up a few minutes here and there and maybe would have helped the flow of the match. But, c'est la vie. 20-minute draw.
I got a bag on Gorilla at the end. He said, you know, I hate to do this because, you know, I love Gorilla, but I got a shit on him a little bit. At the end, he was like, oh, Tonga should have been awarded the match on points.
Yeah, no, I agree.
Yeah, I hate that shit.
Come on, it's not boxing. Yeah, it's not boxing.
I mean, and really, can we amp down the babyface, you know, platitudes, even when it makes no sense whatsoever? I agree with you, John. I caught that too.
No, it was annoying. This is not a banner knife at Gorilla. I think Johnny V drags him down, and they just get sucked into this like bullshit back and forth, and it's just way over the top. It's just not. He is not. They're not a good pair at all. And Ernie Ladd is checked out mentally halfway through. it would have been so much better with Jesse or Lord Al. That would have been better. So, all right, Gene is in the aisle chatting with Bobby Heenan about the main event tonight and exposing Giant Machine. So we'll see if that comes to fruition. Up next is the World's Strongest Man, or as Fink says, recognized as the strongest man in the world today, Ted Arcidi, taking on our old friend Tony Garea, who's always here for a good time. And Ted Arcidi, Scott, is actually working a little heel here. He had turned since we last saw him. Sounds like it looks to me like they're just trying to squeeze whatever they can out of the orange before he just goes bad. He's obviously going nowhere as the lovable giant face, and now they kind of turn him heel and let him be just a guy that's looking to destroy people with his massive strength. And I actually thought he was better suited for heel. Like, he just kind of looks like an asshole. Like, he looks like the douche at the gym. So, I mean, I think it actually is probably a better fit for him.
And he's from Boston.
Right, perfect. Yes, an asshole douchebag from Boston Sports Club.
A masshole.
Yeah, walking around with his stupid red trunk. So, yeah, I mean, I think he was a better fit as a heel, but he's just not good. So he actually gets cheered to start, and Garea gets booed. This is really ugly on paper. Ladd says Arcidi's attitude has changed, and V says he's become more sure in his abilities, and that's why the change. Garea tries to match power early and grabs a side headlock. Garea fails at some shoulder blocks, and Gorilla rips his strategy. Arcidi's power takes over, and he slams Garea around as V talks about how he is liking Arcidi the more he sees him. Arcidi moves through Garea with power strikes as they debate his suit size. Garea lands a few glancing blows and dropkick, but jumps right into a bear hug, and that will be it for him. Arcidi definitely better, like I said, as the asshole jock heel, but just not worth watching. Garea's on borrowed time, just fucking going through the motions at this point as well. And we should note as well, this was not scheduled to be Garea. It was actually supposed to be Tony Atlas, who, as we saw, was not in good graces with the company after MSG, and he is pretty much done right after this. He's one more time, but like we had said, that might be a sub as well. So he's pretty much was done after that match with Adonis a couple days before this. So he's out, and Tony Garea fills in for the last minute for Atlas. I'm not sure if that was an upgrade, a downgrade, or whatever, a wash, but it is what it is.
Yeah, your official time is a merciful 2:41. Tony Garea just kind of went through the motions knowing he was going to lose the match, so they did some goofing off, and the match ends. There's really nothing really to say here. Other than if this was Tony Atlas, we would have a very difficult Junior Universe choice
the
later.
Junior Universe would be imploding upon itself if Atlas and Arcidi were in there together.
It'd be raining juice everywhere. And secondly, it may arguably be the worst match in the history of organized professional wrestling in the entire universe.
We've seen worse on these shows. I think we've seen worse on these shows. It was not good, though. It was not good. But I think there's at least one. Was the one match we saw? It was like a real dumpster fire. There was one that was worse than this, I thought. Probably Atlas Adonis might have been worse than this.
No, but I'm saying if this was Atlas versus...
Arcidi. That would have definitely been awful.
This was fine. This was just a fine squash. I'm saying if they tried to pump up Atlas Arcidi as some kind of juice fest, it would have been abysmal. Yeah. Could it have been worse than the Baron versus Putski?
Oh, God. I haven't found anything worse than that yet. But.
I mean, it would have been pretty close. It would have been pretty close. But in any event, there's really not much to say here. Arcidi gets put over. Garea's just a body hanging out. Hey, want to go get squeezed? Can I find some young boys? And get it done. So there you go. Ted Arcidi wins. Nobody cares. What do you think, John? Oh, and I gave it a dud. Johnny?
Yeah, it's a dud. There's not much to say. I'm just wondering, what was Garea's move planning? It's just like he jumped right into him. What was the move? Was he trying to, you know, at least do a dropkick or something? He just runs.
He didn't give a shit. Garea
jumps right into him. Yeah.
He's fucking. He's another guy cashing checks at this point. Just Fucking who cares?
And unfortunately, I caught the on one of the Boston house shows that was just added. There's the famous RCD Atlas matches. It's about 4 minutes of them trying to put a bear hug on each other, and they're kind of just like grabbing each other's shoulders and dancing around, and they both get counted out. It's it's as dudtastic as you could imagine. It's like a bad hockey fight where, like, after the guys finish punching and they just kind of grab each other's jersey, and it's like 4 minutes of that.
Yeah. That's really terrible.
And I have news for you. We're gonna see these two guys go at it again next week, and it'll be the last time we talk about either of them.
Yeah.
That'll be it.
MSG,
so,
good luck.
Oh, yeah. Oh God, Kelly. Oh, I don't know. I kind of gave it 2 stars. We'll see. We'll see how generous he is since he's off this week. Let's move on. There's nothing more to say here.
Okay. Were you done, John, on that one?
And it's good that Gurria gave up. He couldn't kick out right after the 3 count.
He's done. He knows he's done. All right, Gene is with us again, talking to Jimmy Hart about his finally getting a chance to get even with fuck a Junkyard Dog. This feud has been going on at least October, right? This thing, JYD.
Yeah,
and, Jimmy.
It kind of overlapped.
Oh, wait, what am
I
saying?
Yeah,
year. Even before that, WrestleMania 1 with fucking Valentine. started then. Oh, God.
Yeah, and it overlapped into Saturday's main event with the whole fucking red underwear and all. Oh, yeah, this JYD versus Jimmy Hart is bordering on like 18 months at this point.
This was reignited on the 8-2 Championship Wrestling when JYD was a guest on the Flower Shop. Jimmy Hart tried to attack him. He grabbed a flower pot and cracked Adrian Adonis in the head with it, so... That sets up this. The never-ending Hart-JYD feud rolls on. Adonis gets another crack at the dog, too, after they faced off in the past. Jimmy's carrying a feather duster for some reason. I guess that's what flamboyant gentlemen do. I don't know. Nice ovation for JYD as he grooves out to grab them cakes. Adonis goes right at JYD as he enters, but the dog hammers away with his chain. And, of course, immediately we get the fat jokes and the comments all fire up. Adonis bloodied as JYD starts unleashing his headbutts, sending Adonis scampering back to the Spumoni Gardens, then eventually to the floor. JYD met him at the apron with more right hands and headbutts and then shoved the referee, allowing Jimmy to spray cologne in JYD's eyes. The referee's totally lost as Adonis goes to work with some sloppy offense. Johnny V says Adonis is 300 pounds of solid muscle. JYD ends up outside, and Jimmy starts smacking him, but Dog shrugs it off and trips up Adonis off the top rope. They brawl on the floor and head to back in. JYD throws Adonis at Jimmy Hart. They tumble outside, and Adonis is somehow counted out within 2 seconds. They can even just do the extra 8 seconds. This fucking thing was a mess. This could have actually ended up a pretty fun brawl. They showed some flashes, but just a disastrous structure. Everyone seemed off, and the crowd just chants bullshit as JYD just leaves. Adonis deserves way better, and he just gets stuck in these messes. I went dud on this, and you know what it reminded me of? Like Wrestling Classic. Like some of those shit matches we saw buried in there. It reminded me of that a bit. And I don't know if it's another product of having... You know, we saw WrestleMania 2 as well. Like these cards where they're all of a sudden having 12 to 14 matches. It's like they don't know how to fucking handle the spacing them out. And they end up doing these weird things where they rush without much of a... You know, plan or format to it. And it just ends up being a mess instead of any kind of hot or decent brawl. What do you think of that, John? You think there's anything to that?
Yeah, definitely. I don't even know if it was a DQ or a count out. There were the announcers weren't even sure. It's like JYD hits the ref, and then the ref doesn't do anything, and then Adrian winds up just getting DQ'd or a count out. They didn't even make that clear. Yeah, it was a big mess. It only gets a half star just for Adrian's bumps. He did the best he could. And of course, when Adrian was like crotching himself on the rope, Gorilla repeats his famous line: "Oh, Adrian always wanted to be a soprano." you just can't resist with those. But just a mess, man.
Yeah, I gave this a dud as well, and I feel bad for Adonis. I don't know what's going on. I mean, it's a combination of that, JR, but I feel like a lot of guys are like checking out. It's like. Like you said, JYD, all right, it's over, and, you know, bell rings.
Well, I think they know when it's, like, a sloppy mess. And, again, it's like, I just think they don't know how to time this shit out. Like, all of a sudden they get 12 matches on this big show, and they're just like, all right, go out there for 3 minutes, fuck around, and then stupid finish. Like, and I mean, in JYD, you know, it was probably high as a fucking kite, too, which doesn't help. But, I don't know. It's just, like, the MSG shows, the finishes aren't great, but that's usually, like, the referee fucks it up or something. But we've noticed a trend now between Wrestling Classic, WrestleMania 2, and now here, when they start having these shoehorn matches in and speed them up, everything goes wonky, and they don't have any cohesion. Like, this could have been a quick 3-minute red hot brawl into like a double count out or something, but instead it kind of start stops and then we get a confusing ending.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I feel like once again, like they just got disappointed. The match was so bad. I can't believe the referee or the timekeeper. Like, who's paying attention? I mean, Adonis literally, I think, had 3/4 of his girth go through the rope, and then the bell rang. I mean, what's the deal? I mean, yeah. I agree with you, JR. I think sometimes they just don't get accustomed to loading these cards up, and I don't even know what the hell to do. I mean, this wasn't even like legit. Not, I shouldn't say legitimately televised, but I don't think they had like a TV time limit, like a regular MSG house show or something. So no. I don't know what the deal was with having to do all this rushing. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And I think that affected the match. I think they got in their heads, all right, we only got and the official time of this match, by the way, was 4:15. So they're probably thinking, all right, we only got 4 minutes. Let's do a lot of fucking bullshit. And then it became a goddamn mess. So, I mean, I don't know.
JYD, yeah, he's getting past his usefulness really quickly here. I mean, we'll have a little bit more going on, but the Jimmy Hart stuff needs to end. Like, it's just, whatever. I'm kind of done with him chasing Jimmy Hart around and getting annoyed at Jimmy Hart. It's like, you know, move along. But he's still over, but he's past any kind of usefulness, I think.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, we had said a lot, obviously, through 85 that JYD, even with Tito chasing Hammer for the IC belt, it was evident that they always positioned JYD as the number 2 babyface in the company behind Hogan. But now it's evident that the roster is little by little getting bigger and bigger, and JYD's getting bigger and bigger. And, you know, there's other guys that are on the horizon that are just that much more important. So I think JYD showed that. So this is just a mess. Back-to-back duds. And like I've said, this crowd has not been overly fired up yet. Mm. So if you were watching this live as you got to this point, you're probably thinking, ooh, this is not going
to
end well.
Did it even air live? I meant to ask that.
No.
It was only on tape later, right?
Yeah, so that's my point. If it's on tape, then what the fuck's the problem? Just, you know, give everybody like a decent amount of time and roll with it. I don't know what the rush is.
Why do we have shit commentary? Like, just record it later, you know, like in a better spot. It's just,
I know, exactly. Yeah. Have Gorilla and Jesse, like, you know, come here to Stanford, go to the booth, and have him, Gorilla and Jesse, just do over it. You know, I don't know. They were like, and they were like so far away. Like, yeah, you could tell they were probably like in the press box or whatever behind home plate, and the ring was like out in center field. I don't know what the hell they could be looking at.
No, they're watching the TV. That's it.
Yeah, the monitor. So anyway, this match is a dud. It was not good. Not good at all. I don't know if it wasn't worse than, if you have to rank duds, this was not worse than the Arcidi mess, but this was not.
No, not good.
This might have been more disappointing because you had 2 better workers.
Well, one better. And, but JYD.
One and a half workers. I guess.
Adonis needs he needs what he has coming, which is good. With the rejuvenation.
There's no doubt about it. Okay. No doubt about it.
All right, up next we have a debut, and that is, of course, of Dick Slater, who grew up in Tampa in the early 70s, turned down a chance to play for the Miami Dolphins, probably a good idea, to get into wrestling instead. He was trained in Tampa, started his career with Eddie Graham CWF. After leaving Florida, Slater spent time in California and Nevada before heading to Georgia, where he finally broke out. After spending 8 successful years in Georgia, Slater headed to the Carolinas to work for Jim Crockett. Remained there until jumping to WWF in 1986. He remained in the company until early 87 and then returned to Jim Crockett and stayed there until the transition through WCW, and actually competed in that promotion until his back injury ended his career in 1996. And we do see him here tonight as a face taking on Iron Mike Sharp. Interesting decision, I thought, to call him the Rebel and have him wear like the Rebel flag all over him and then be a face. Odd choices at this time. Sharp gets a decent slot here on the big card, and as always we get the stalling from good old Iron Mike, with Slater landing shots here and there. Ladd puts over Sharp's training and conditioning. Slater gets a monkey flip and some arm drags and goes to work on the leg until Sharp jabs him in the eye. Slater comes back with some strikes and a small package for 2, goes to the eyes again and snaps Slater's neck across the top rope before kicking and punching away. Slater comes back with a suplex for 2 and then works over Sharp in the corner, hitting a neck breaker and a Russian leg sweep. Slater heads up top and lands an elbow to the head into a jackknife pin for the win. Fine match. It chugged right along. It didn't meander like the usual Sharp matches have. I really thought Slater was better suited for a heel, though. I mean, I guess, you know, he's like a decent enough looking guy, and he's got good work rate, but I just thought he'd be better kind of controlling the match versus just selling a bunch, especially for a guy like Sharp. And he didn't exactly ooze charisma in this role. I mean, maybe it's just the miscasting, but I think he could have been better as like a heavy, maybe, you know, him and a tag team with like him and Dory Funk would have been pretty great, actually, with Jimmy Hart managing them. But anyway, this is fine enough. And again, we've said it before, but you can tell that the bloom is off them like sharp rose, because we're going from draws and longer matches to now he's just clearly squash fodder, even though he's getting a slot here. So he's like a notch above the standard jobber, but he's clearly not going anywhere fast. What'd you think, Scott?
Before we get to the match, I just want to look up, because you sit here with your usual Jets bitterness, but it says he had a chance to play football for the Dolphins. I'm assuming had he played for the Dolphins,
he would have beat his.
He probably would have been on the undefeated 17-0 team. So this isn't like the fucking the Ryan Tannehill Dolphins. So why don't you just put your bitterness away and realize that he might have had a ring on probably one of the greatest teams ever. So
he wouldn't have made the team. Come on. And then he'd be just as annoying as all the other idiots who celebrate when everyone loses like they do now.
Oh, they pop the champagne when the undefeated serve. I'm a gigantic Dick Slater fan. Loved him in Crockett. And really, when I became a wrestling fan in 83, that, besides my love of Morocco and Snuka, because that was the first feud I watched as a WWF fan, watching, NWA on Saturdays, that was like the first big feud, because him and Orton with the bounty on Flair for Harley and the big Starcade feud. I mean, big Dirty Dick Slater fan. So I remember when he came to the WWF, and I said, I'm curious your thoughts too, John. I was just perplexed, like why did they make him a babyface and have him walking around with a rebel flag? And I mean, he could might as well teamed with Orndorff, and they could have both saying things about spider monkeys. I mean, I don't know. It seemed very strange why he's a babyface. I don't get it. Vince was weird like that. Like, anytime somebody was hot in another promotion, unless they're just so over that you can't really switch them, that he has to do the opposite just because he needs to invent it. Like, just because throughout most of his career leading up to this, Dick Slater was a great heel, Vince has to make him a babyface, because if I make him a heel, the people will say, oh, you're just siphoning off other promo. And that whole philosophy is fucking stupid when it's clearly ruining a guy that's just better off as a villain. And, he should have just had Dick Slater be a heel. Like I said, maybe, honestly, if Haas was leaving and you needed Jimmy Jack, you might as well just have Dick Slater and Jimmy Jack Funk. Why the hell not? I mean, Dick Slater's just as experienced to a certain extent as Haas is. So why not just have, Slater team with Jimmy Jack as a heel team? You know what I'm saying? Vince just had that weirdness about him where he couldn't just let a guy be a guy just because he was that character somewhere else. I mean, it's ludicrous. We weren't that – I mean, I know kayfabe was alive, but, we weren't all that stupid. I mean, it just made no sense to make Dick Slater a babyface. It really didn't. Having said that, your official match time is 6:24, and you're right. Iron Mike Sharp used to at least, whether the matches annoyed you or not, at least he got some legitimate chances. There was no legitimate chances here. He was there to just eat the pin, and that was that. So the match was fine. I gave it a star. I thought it was – nothing crazy, but John, before you get into your analysis, I want your thoughts, because obviously you watched 83 NWA like I did. Didn't you find it odd? Like, why didn't he just have him come in as a heel? Because remember, he was awesome babyface in all those promotions for those few years leading up to coming here. And it just made no sense. You know what I mean? Like, it seemed like that. I don't know how hard you had to try to be a babyface, but they might as well just kept him a Dirty Dick Slater and let him be part of Jimmy Hart's thing or whatever. You know what I'm saying? Like, right? Didn't it just seem weird because we were watching that stuff,
I think in general that there was just no way that Slater was going to cut it in the WWF. I mean, he just screams Southern wrestling, NWA, mm-hmm. Whatever. He was just so out of place here. I just felt it was never going to happen from the jump with Slater, unfortunately. I mean, he's solid in the ring and all that, but there was just no way. He just has NWA and Southern written all over him, so it wasn't going to happen. But I gave it a start too. I enjoyed a Sharp, like I said before, with the mic was right on him, and just throughout the whole match, he never stopped with his complaining and his grunting and his all loud. I just love his little antics. He makes it entertaining, Mike Sharp.
Mike Dull is more like it.
Dirty Dick Dull.
All right, here we go. So next up, what was not dull is a continuation of a few that we really dug into on our last show, and that is the ongoing issues between the Machines and Lou Albano and Big John Studd, King Kong Bundy, and more importantly, the Heenan family. Is Bobby Heenan still trying to unmask the giant machine? He's hell-bent to prove that it is Andre so he can get Tony to permanently suspend him. So the big feud continuing as the match here tonight is indeed two of the Machines, Big and Super, teaming up with their manager, Lou Albano, to take on Stud Bundy and Bobby Heenan. The Machines still have their funky music. Good heat on this one for sure with all seven men in there. Stud and Super start things off with some shoving and a stare down. Super tries to slam Stud but can't get him all the way up. Continue to meander a bit until Super knocks Stud down to the floor and celebrates wildly. Giant shoves Stud back in and he tags Bundy. Gorilla thinks Bundy's 500 pounds as he grabs a side headlock on Big Machine. The two collide on a shoulder block and neither budge as Gorilla says Lou told him he has a machine factory and who knows how many he'll be churning out. Big levels Bundy with a forearm and follows with more hard strikes. Bundy slugs him down and tags Stud who works over Big Machine before tagging in Heenan, who goes right for the mask. Super comes in and drills Bobby and then scurries to tag Stud. Super tags back in and hammers away at Stud, but Stud levels him and tags Bundy, who kicks away. Johnny V calls Albano a fat slob, winning me over just a bit, and says he's too busy eyeing all the hot dog and pizza salesmen to get involved in the match. Bobby tags in, as does Lou, and the crowd fires up for this one, rallying Lou. Bobby slaps Lou, but Lou punches him back and slings him to the corner and then stomps away. Heenan goes to the eyes and clubs Lou from behind before tagging in Stud. Things break down as everyone brawls. Giant gets in the ring and wipes out Stud, Bundy, and Heenan to save Lou, drawing the DQ. He keeps cleaning house, eventually getting a hard shot on Bobby until Heenan's crew finally takes off. This was fine. It was carried by the heat mainly in the big manager showdown. That was a fun moment. The story continues to be good, but in the ring there's only so much these guys can really do. I thought Super Machine looked great again. He's kind of been the star to me of this team so far. And Bobby fails to unmask the Giant yet again, so that will live on. I went two stars here. John Scott, why don't we talk about the match, and we'll talk about Albano, because this is pretty much it for him, too. But, John, what did you think of this match?
First of all, in my notes, Gorilla's having a real bad night because he kept calling him, instead of Big, Super, and Giant, he kept calling him, oh, Machine 1, 2, and 3.
Oh, yeah, he's all over
the
place.
He never called him Big, Super, and Giant. That's another. This got to be one of Gorilla's worst outings. And I hate to do it because I love him, man. But he's having a bad night. And when Johnny V, I know the same thing. That was one of his few funny moments. But him of all people, fat shaming Albano. You know, he's not exactly Jack O'Lean either. And, he couldn't wait to say, "Oh, that fat Albano is probably ordering a hot dog. When is he going to get in the ring?"
Right.
But kudos to the Brain, because for Albano's one moment when he threw like one punch and Brain bumped for him like he was Hulk Hogan and stuff, you know, very professional of Bobby to bump and jump around for Fat Slob Albano, and he made him look like $1 million because back then when the managers would get into the ring, that was a huge pop for the crowd,
right?
And now was the big moment in the house. But I went 1.5. It was just it seemed like as soon as Albano got in trouble, then Andre, Giant came in and had to save him.
I gave it 2 stars as well. I liked it. I thought it was good. I think Albano, is a big fat sloppy pig, and there's no doubt, Johnny, that as this and JR, as this show progressed, that Johnny V really didn't give two fucking shits about the show at all. It did seem like he was kind of honing down his stand-up act. It really does, because he starts doing it pretty soon after this. So you could tell that he's just kind of going through the motions, and Gorilla just fell for it. Like, he didn't even... you really had to feel bad for Ernie Ladd as the show progressed, because, I mean, Gorilla and Ernie together would have been probably really, really good. And having Johnny on this was just a fucking waste of time. And Gorilla, unfortunately, took the lazy way out and just dealt with the heel face bitching rather than really working with Ernie and putting on a great broadcast or whatever. Even if it was on tape, they could at least make a little bit of an effort. Your official match time is 7:49. I liked it. I thought it was, everybody moved, fairly well. And the crowd was slowly starting to get into the show. The Machine's gimmick was funny because, we're all in on the joke except, Gorilla. And I was curious to see how far this machine's gimmick would go. And I wonder, again, you know, obviously negotiations were going on with other wrestlers. I'm wondering if we're slowly seeing, like, the thinning out of guys. Like, you know, Stud and Bundy are slowly becoming pretty much a fucking joke. So I don't know how far they go. And I feel like a lot of the roster is at the point now where you're starting to see some fleshing out. But the match itself is pretty solid for what it was. Bobby does his best to bump for the fat pig. And the machines, you know, keep on trucking along. So I thought the crowd was pretty good and got it going. So
Albano.
Yeah, 2 stars.
We'll see Albano again just one more time on an MSG show. But for all intents and purposes, he's done here. He wrestles a couple more matches and manages a couple more. And then we'll end up just pretty much making spot appearances here and there. Would go to the UWF for a bit in 1991 and then would return in 1994. So, I mean, we'll talk about him again, obviously, going forward. This isn't it for him. He'd have his issues with Vince when he leaves. He does the idiot's guy for pro wrestling and kind of ends up shitting on WWF a bit in there as well. But as a regular performer, he's pretty much done. Yeah, Scott, I guess we can kind of save our comments for him when we see his kind of last appearance in MSG. But, John, do you want to give any thoughts on Albano leaving at this point?
Not much. I had and some of the shoot interviews, I think it was Hillbilly Jim, was cracking on him because Lou stepping into the ring, he thought he was going to get a lot more cashola, and he was pretty much getting paid the same. So I think that was one of his big beefs with Vince, and that's what caused him to kind of tip on out at this time.
Which is dumb because he's lucky he had a job at all at this point.
But considering what his lifestyle was at the time, he's lucky he's still fucking alive. I mean, you know.
I mean, I've watched.
Yeah, but for all, to get him to play the devil's advocate, he did. He did the crowds went crazy for him. You know, at this time, anytime like the managers got into it, like all he did, he threw like one punch to Heenan, and Heenan flew all over the place, and that was like one of the biggest pops of the night. So, I gotta give him a little credit.
Whatever.
I don't know if he had anything to do with it, but yeah.
That's Bob, more Bobby than him. I mean, I've watched more Albano the last like year and a half than I've ever wanted to in my life between those TNTs for the Network Adventure and then these shows. And I'm missing it. I know that he had his run and why he was what he was. And I've enjoyed him slightly more than I had in the past. Like some of the TNT stuff wasn't bad. I don't know. I guess the Bulldog stuff was okay, like with him helping them to get to the belt. But just since then, it's just kind of been there. It's fine that he was around, I guess, to legitimize the machines. I thought he was forced being the manager of Andre or like the liaison for Andre. Like, I didn't think that was needed at all. I guess it's just annoying that he's kind of the de facto manager for every face that has a push. Like, that's what it felt like. Yeah, like, he's involved with Hogan during the War to Settle the Score stuff, and then he's with Andre, then he's with the tag champs, now he's with the machines. You know, it's just he's like just shoved into every top level babyface acting feud, so it was just kind of wearing thin. Like, to me, as we're nearing the end of 86, if you'll notice, we keep talking about guys that are going, and we'll see that heavily through 87. We're just really into a transition period as we're starting to really filter out a lot of that old guard that we're around through the early 80s, and as Vince was starting to take over. And guys that we've seen heavily on these MSG shows, they're all starting to dissipate one by one. Like we said, we mentioned Tony Atlas is gone, Tony Garea's on his way out, now Albano. So, I mean, it's all these guys we've been watching are starting to fade slowly.
I don't think there's any doubt. And I think you could see it in the match quality, to be honest with you. I think you're seeing some of these guys, you know, feeling like, you know, Vince is finding TV-friendly guys and guys that are more, you know, camera ready, and I think you're seeing some of these other slugs kind of realizing the writing on the wall, and they're packing it in. I don't think it's the last time. I have a feeling it's not the last time we're going to see it either. So, well, we're about halfway through. Why don't we take a breather, Johnny? What do you think of the show so far?
Meh, not so much.
Yeah,
even the crowd's a little disappointed.
I agree.
I think maybe, you know, obviously it's got a lot to do with the action, but also it was very cold that night for late August. it like got into the fourth. It kind of reminded of a certain WrestleMania where somebody had to snuggle with Judy Martin to keep warm. It reminded me from all accounts.
Hey, I got some corn muffins out of that. Damn you!
It was back same weather. It was like 60s during the day, and then once nighttime hit, it got into like the 40s. So maybe that had something to do with it. But yeah, the crowd and of course the matches themselves are meh. So
yeah, no, they're all like bundled up, and you can tell that there is definitely pretty frigid there on that night. Which probably affected. I think part of it too is I don't know if they have the technology to properly mic an outdoor stadium like that on a night like this too. Like I'm guessing that's part of it. It's such a large crowd that you're just not, it's an open air stadium, crisp, cool air. Like the noise is probably just kind of traveling up and out. Like it's not, they just don't have the situation mic'd as well. So I'm guessing that's part of it too. It's just
it's heavily
mic'd
around by the ring, but definitely not so much the crowd.
Right. So that's probably part of it too.
All right, well, we take a break. We'll come back. We've got, 5 matches left. A couple of real dandies as well. And, of course, our main event
for
the World Wrestling.
Jim Dandies.
The World Wrestling Federation title is on the line. But first, let's move on to a break. Because?
Yeah, baby.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Hey, pro wrestling announcer Kevin Kelly here. I want to make sure you are all subscribed to all the great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. It's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, which, of course, includes the full archives of the Kevin Kelly Show, the Place to Be Nation pod feed, and the pro wrestling only feed. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And be sure to give Justin your true thoughts. I mean, don't hold back. After all, he is kind of a jerk. Just listen to Scott.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rizzero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlayStation.com. And we offer those to you on 3 great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, we bring you the Mothership, the original Place to Be podcast, as well as Main Event, Lucha Afterground, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows, as well as the Our Vantage Point podcast and Jeff Learns Wrestling. In addition to these full-length shows, we also deliver quick-hit pod blasts on topics old and new.
Over on the Pro Wrestling Only feed, we dive deep inside the wrestling business with a stacked army of experts leading the way. The feed features potpourri shows such as This Week in Wrestling, Greetings from Allentown, Psychology is Dead, Puro Potpourri, Stacy and Elliot's Bogus Journey, and the Military Industrial Suplex. We also have shows that focus intently on certain topics like Letters from Center Stage, Space City, and NWA Classics On Demand Adventure, Through the Years, Strong Style History, Strong Style Story, and Mount Olympus. Plus, the feed has the full archives of legendary shows like Titans of Wrestling, Where the Big Boys Play, Letters from Kayfabe, and much more. And on our popular Place to Be Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, Rank and File, PTBN Dadcast, Go Home in a Box, NBA Team, and Lucha Undead, as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans with the Hard Traveling Fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversation, Geek and Sassy, and Imaginary Stories podcasts.
You can find all of these current shows plus archives of our past podcasts, including The Kevin Kelly Show, as well by subscribing to all of our feeds on iTunes, and while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows, plus others, available on PlacetoBeNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth stretch projects and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlacetoBeNation.com/Amazon when shopping online, and download our free PTB Vintage Vault Refresh ebooks via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, and Fall River, Massachusetts, TheHistoryOfWrestling.com, and Scott Keith's Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlacetoBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Hey, this is Dr. Tom Pritchard, and you're listening to the Place to Be podcast on the Place to Be Nation.
All right, Nation, we're back taking a look at the big event from August of 1986 in Toronto, Ontario, Canada. Scott and myself, joined by Mr. John D'Amato, and, you know, it was about a month ago, guys. We were at a wedding. Dan McGinn and his new wife, we all got to hang out, did some dancing, and it brought us all to a different plane of higher love. And, of course, speaking of higher love, that's the song you'll be hearing underneath us tonight, because that is the one and only Steve Winwood playing us the number two song in the nation on this week, because the number one song we heard last week on our MSG review. Of course, we're just 2 days removed from that show. But as you hear that song, as always, that means we're going to bring in Scott Criscullo for the Pop Culture Corner.
Thank you, JR. Abbreviated because this week, because as JR said, we were only 3 days after the house show. The house show we did was on the 25th. This is the 28th. So this is Thursday. The show was on Monday. So so we're not going to go over everything again. If you remember, Papa Don't Preach by Madonna. Was it Papa Don't Preach? Let me just confirm that. Was it Open Your Heart?
No, it was Papa Don't Preach.
It was Papa Don't Preach. So Papa Don't Preach was number one. So this week we're playing the number two song from that countdown. And that was Higher Love by Steve Winwood. Obviously, the movies were the same. We won't get into that. But we'll just do a little baseball because it was a separate day. Thursday, August 28th, 1986. There were seven games on that date. Mr. D'Amato, yours and my best team in baseball had the night off.
The night off.
JR, your beloved Yankees at the Kingdome in Seattle defeated the Mariners 4-2. Dennis Rasmussen won his 14th. And Ricky Say had his 22nd home run of the year. Dave Rigetti, his 31st save, which at the time, for late August of 86, was actually pretty high. And, of course, he would get a lot more by the end of the year. And we'll mention him for Kelly. His Blue Jays defeated the Cleveland Indians. Of course, they weren't playing where they normally play, because we're there now. But they were in Cleveland at the old Municipal Stadium, and they beat the Indians 9-1. The standings to this point in the AL East, the Red Sox with a 4.5 game lead over the Blue Jays. Yes. The Angels, 4.5 game lead over Texas. Houston with a 7-game lead over the Giants and Reds. And, Johnny, just throw it out there. At this point, the Phillies were in second place. How far ahead do you think we were of the Phillies at this point, late August?
We.
Take a shot in the dark.
I got 16 games.
20.
20.
20 ahead of the Phillies, 22 ahead of the Cardinals. Motherfucker. All right, so there's your baseball, and that's pretty much it. But, JR, just letting everyone know, get yourself ready. Because on our next house show, you know what we're going to start doing again.
Oh, boy.
Take the field. The 1986 NFL season.
I hope I can repeat my year of 1985-86. I was excellent picking those games. So
you were. I'm actually going to keep track of your stand. I'm going to keep track of your picks. So we'll see.
I don't have the Bears, though, to just pick every week this time. So
No. But John, I forgot. Who was the really good team in 80s? I don't really remember. You know, maybe you do. I don't know. Anyway.
The Jets are good, too, for the beginning.
They were pretty good, yeah. So next week on our next house show, September house show at the Garden, we will start doing a little NFL football as the 1986 season is upon us. Of course, our three teams looking quite fine. Well, maybe you go. Well, actually, the Cowboys were defending division champions. So we'll talk more about that next week. But for this evening, our pop culture report is complete.
I would have preferred back in the high life again, get some implications out on the yacht, you know. So looking back historically, I went through the Weather Underground Almanac, August 28th, 1986. That's the date we're looking at right here for this show.
Yes. Yep.
It was actually a Thursday, that show. Thursday night.
Yeah, that's what I said. Yep. Thursday. Yep.
And, the low temperature on that day was actually 60 degrees Fahrenheit. 73 was the high. So if this is accurate, it's not that cold, but I guess maybe sitting outside, dark, 60 can feel a little chilly. So you bundle up a bit, but it's,
maybe it's breezy.
Yeah, it's not exactly 40 degrees or 30 degrees or anything like that. I thought Canadians were tough.
Yeah, no, I saw somewhere that it got into the 40s, but I guess different accounts, yeah.
Yeah, who knows? This could be wrong. This is the Weather Underground Almanac, but we'll see. Now, I'll search for another source maybe before I go out and stand by it. All right, so next up we have a big blow-off match to a huge feud that's been going on, and that is Ricky Steamboat battling Jake Roberts in a snake pit match. Of course, if you remember, back on the 5-3 Sirens main event, the match ended when Roberts viciously DDT'd Steamboat on the exposed concrete floor. Steamboat had a concussion, came back, cut his hair, and wore the headband to remind him of what went down. Steamboat assaulted Roberts after a match on the 5-3 Championship Wrestling. They battled across the country. On 7-16 All-Star Wrestling, Steamboat again attacked Jake preventing him from using a sneak on his prone opponent. On the 727 Maple Leaf Garden show, Roberts refused to compete in his match against Steve Yaffe and said claimed that he would never wrestle in Toronto again unless it was Ricky Steamboat in his own type of match. And that sets up this snake pit match, which is basically just a no rules match, no DQ, no count out. And of course, Ricky Steamboat had begun carrying around, I think by this point, the little mini Komodo dragon to go up against the snake and counteract Damien. Because Gorilla notes here that they were supposed to bring them down to ringside, the snake and the dragon, but they deemed it was too dangerous an environment for them. So there you go. The snake pit rules, I thought, perfect way for this to go, demanding there has to be a winner in this. Jake is wearing a very interesting robe. I'm kind of sad he didn't wear it more often. I kind of enjoyed it. Steamer meets Jake at the ropes as he comes in. They trade blows. The flurry ends with Jake bailing outside as Gorilla's reminding us what happened inside its main event. Jake comes back in but's met with more fists and chops before Steamer goes to the arm. Jake fights free and trades big punches until Steamer takes control and hammers away. Things spill outside where Jake crunches Steamer with a hard right hand and slams him hard to the mat. Johnny V says this pineapple's flying out of Steamer's ears and calls him a Hawaii 5-0 reject. There you go. Jake drapes him over the platform and drops hard knees and then tries to use a chair, but Steamboat punches him away. Steamboat grabs a chair and levels Jake with it, pitches him inside where he heads up top and hits a big karate chop for two before going to the arm. Steamboat keeps hammering away, but Jake's able to shoot him hard to the corner, up and over. Jake follows him out and stomps away before slingshotting him into the post. Jake is all over Steamboat on the floor, back inside, crushing Steamboat with hard right hands and a short clothesline. Steamboat avoids a DDT, but levies in a chop. Jake cuts him down with an inverted atomic drop and a hard gut buster. Jake covers lazily by kneeling on Steamboat. Steamboat reaches his legs up and locks Jake into a sunset flip for the flash win. This was a fun match. It was a pretty hot brawl. It was a good atmosphere. The guys worked hard. Lots of shine and made their offense count when they got it in. We get some good brawling as well, which is fitting for this heated feud. I wasn't too crazy about the finish. I don't know. I'll give Jake credit for at least kind of teeing it up by covering like cocky and lazily leading up to that, so it wasn't just out of nowhere. But it just kind of felt un-Jake like the way he pinned him and set up the sunset flip was kind of obvious. But I still went 3 stars for this. It was really good. I've enjoyed the feud overall. So what are your thoughts, Scott?
The feud has been fantastic, and I love this match. I gave it 3 stars. Your official time, 10:17. I thought they gave it a lot of time. I thought it was a really good brawl. And I got to tell you something, you know, watching all these shows, you know, when you're a kid, you don't remember a lot of these house shows. You watch mostly, obviously, the TV squashes and then pay-per-views. You know for a fact that Steamboat's one of the greatest technical wrestlers of all time. I think that's a comfortable opinion that really is undisputed. But he was a hell of a brawler, and I don't think he gets enough credit for being able to adapt to just flat out fights. You know what I mean? And I think this feud, and the Morocco feud really opened up Steamboat to really being a good brawler. You know, I don't know how much brawling he did the years he was in Crockett, because I wasn't watching, obviously, late 70s, early 80s. You mostly remember his, you know, the U.S. title feuds with Flair and the matches with Tully. But you really never saw a brawling Steamboat. And I got to tell you, he really knew how to adapt to guys that obviously technically couldn't really match him. And look, I'm not throwing shade on Jake by any stretch. But, you know, he was a good in-ring guy, but he knew how to brawl. And this match was conducive to that. And I thought they were tremendous. And I really think Steamboat does not get enough credit for being able to adapt to into flat-out fights and brawls. I think everyone thinks he's a, you know, clean technical wrestler and kind of goes above that. But when he's pissed, he'll show it. And I applaud him for it. I think it adds a lot even more to his in-ring package. So, I was floored once again at how great this match was, as the other matches he had when he was in deep feuds with the guy, with like Morocco. And we're going to definitely see that in his next big feud. But tonight you definitely saw a Steamboat that you normally don't see,
right?
Every time out. And I was very impressed with that. The ending, yeah, was a little meh, but I mean, very physical match. I think they trusted each other. Maybe they worked together earlier in the decade. Maybe, you know, maybe Steamboat took a dip down to Georgia and him and Jake had some, you know, Georgia TV titles. So who knows? But they definitely felt comfortable with each other because they really laid in on each other here. And it ended up making the match so much better. So I one of Steamboat's better matches that we've watched in this run since we started.
And just
so,
a note from Chad, he said this finished 52nd on the first Death Valley Driver project, which I'm thinking, I think he means matches of the 80s. And then they have a match in Boston earlier this month on August 9th, which they said was the ninth best match of the WWF in the 80s. So there you go. I'll have to check that one out.
And I think that did. I wonder if that. I wonder if that match hit the network. I'll have to see. Johnny, what do you think?
Oh yes, that match is on there. You guys should check it out because it's a slightly bitterness, but I like this match too. 3 stars. My only criticism is it was supposed to be a snake pit, anything goes, no DQ, and they really didn't utilize that. They really didn't break the rules. There was a Steamboat, a couple chair shots, and that's about it. Jake hit Ricky with a slingshot into the post, but they didn't really go like extreme and go over the top with the no DQ. And the only thing that keeps it from like 4 stars is me too. The finish was a little. I mean, Ricky just got a little roll up. He didn't really get his revenge. Well, like he just got a little roll up. I mean, he got the win, but he didn't really instigate that violence for revenge for that DDT for that big angle. So that's the only criticism. But otherwise, it's definitely a solid match. And I liked at the end where Ricky was like pumping his fist. And he had the blood running down his forehead, and he was really like celebrating like a victory. Like it was like a legitimate like sports victory, like somebody celebrating a home run or a touchdown. He was really good at that.
And they would still work the houses for a while here, through September and maybe.
That match in Boston is a slight uptick, especially because Ricky gets the pin, and then Jake after the match hits him with a little DDT action. So it was a little more violent. So, but for here, this is more of a crowd pleasing finish for this one.
All right, it looks like they're paired together through the end of September. So pretty much the end of the feud, except for some select towns. So Steamboat goes over and puts a bow on that feud that started back on the Saturday's main event with a great DDT on the floor. All right, up next, we have a big Bruiser Power Haas feud still going on. These guys have been working the independent house show circuit. We saw them go to a draw last week at MSG in a surprisingly decent little match. Herc is out there alone tonight. No Slick or Freddie Blass. He's pacing around his manic energy, kind of channeling Bruiser Brody, I thought, more so on this night, even with kind of the noises he was making. Haynes gets an okay response, kind of tepid. Johnny V and Ladd disappear. They go to a break as Gorilla calls this match on his own. We get a slow start until Haynes grabs a side headlock and drops Herc with a shoulder block. Herc levels Haynes with a clothesline, goes to work as we lose the commentary completely now due to audio issues. Haynes comes back with a clothesline and press slams Hercules. Haynes mares Herc over and lands a dropkick, as you can now hear all the crowd's catcalls, such as, "Nice dropkick, you almost hit him." That was my favorite one. Haynes grabs a side headlock and cranks away. Herc escapes and bulls Haynes to the floor with a shoulder block and meets him with an axe blow. Herc slams Haynes on the floor and then goes to work on the back when they return. Gorilla finally comes back in just as Herc grabs a bear hug and locks it in. Haynes claps free, but Herc maintains control until they collide heads and collapse. And the crowd is just totally checked out on this one, as Haynes makes a comeback with some kicks and a back elbow and an elbow drop for two. Haynes gets a full Nelson, but Herc quickly powers out and knocks Haynes to the floor. Back inside, Herc gets a lazy cover for two and another near fall on a clothesline. Haynes gets a roll up for two, but Herc keeps him on top of the right hands. Haynes dodges one and gets a backslide for the win. Again, this is a match that just kind of existed. Not nearly as crisp and hard-hitting as that one we talked about last week at MSG, which I liked a lot better. This felt like just a much slower version. They did get some decent stiff shots in. It's still solid for these guys, but just a little long in plotting. Haynes gets the win. We'll see if they can move on to something else for a bit here and break up this battle of powered full Nelson men. So I went 1.5 stars on this, John. What'd you have?
Yeah, I had 1.5, too. There's not much to it, and the lack of commentary brings it down even further. It was a little offsetting. Like I said, Gorilla said, "Oh, they went off to get libations," and but then you only pick up unfortunately the mic picked up that one douchey fan that we all been stuck next to. The one guy that thinks he's smarter than everybody that has to point out that wrestling is predetermined. He's saying, "Oh, nice dropkick, you almost hit him," and nice punch there.
Right.
That one smart fan. Although then again, this is Toronto, so maybe he was the one guy that realized that wrestling is predetermined, because this is Toronto after all. So maybe he was the only one. But other than that, there's not much to it. Just a simple brawl and And Billy Jack gets the win.
Yeah, I gave it a star. Your official match time. It's funny, JR, you said this is long and plodding, and it was 6:08.
This felt longer than the 20-minute match. Yeah, this felt longer than the draw last week.
You know why? I think I agree with John. I think it was the lack of announcers. Yeah. I think it just seemed like it was so barren that it did seem very long. I don't know what the allure was of having just these two guys always wrestling. As we know, this will certainly not be the last time. I don't know what the allure was of having these two fight all the time. You know, Billy Jack's pretty experienced. I always thought he was a guy that could have been a great NWA champion. As I was when we were doing the adventure, and I was watching a lot of those 85 NWAs. I mean, they seemed to really make him look like a stud that could have been a future NWA champion. And Herc was a decent power guy, but you could tell that he wasn't quite molded yet to be a disciplined power worker. So there was definitely some holes that needed to be filled in his game, but they did the best they could for 6 minutes, and obviously they'll get more accustomed to each other as time progresses. Obviously, yeah, the lack of announcing really fucked this in a bad way. Yeah, that's pretty much it. I mean, you'll see more of them throughout the fall, but I'm really curious to see. I'm looking forward to seeing Billy Jack in different feuds, because again, as when we were kids, all we pretty much remembered was these two fighting each other till, you know, the big one when we get there. But I really want to see Billy Jack in some other roles, and Hercules definitely needs to kind of expand himself a little bit before we get like a legitimate, you know, a big feud out of him. So I gave it a star. There's really can't go much further than that.
All right. Very good.
So, yeah.
All right.
Next up.
Gene is now chatting with Jack Tunney. He talks about his pride in the show and the fact that it's being run in Toronto. So there you go. And now we have a tag team tilt, another two teams passing each other up on the ladder, and that is the Dream Team battling the Fabulous Rougeau Brothers, or I guess just, are they Fabulous? Yeah, they're just the Rougeau Brothers, Jacques and Ramon.
Just the Rougeau Brothers, yeah. They're just the shows.
And while they're new to us, Scott, because we have not seen them yet, they've actually been around since February. That's when they signed their deal, and they've been working around the country since then on TV as well, just not at MSG or not on, at WrestleMania. So we have not seen them yet. And, of course, they are the offspring of Jacques Rougeau Sr., legendary Canadian wrestling promoter. They began teaming in Montreal in the 70s. After a memorable and successful run in their home promotion, they headed to the States in February of 86 to sign on with the WWF. I don't think I ever realized they're around this long in 86. I thought they came around, you know, close to the beginning of the show, but
me too. I agree.
All right. So, again, the Rougeaus, are exciting face team, Dream Team, pretty much cooked as a legit threat. They've had a strong sustained run, but almost out of gas. Johnny V stays in the booth for this one as well. Obviously he's not going to make it down to ringside in time. Dream Team attacked the Rougeaus before the bell as V makes fun of the French Canadians. Rougeaus turn the tide as all four men are brawling, and then the Dream Team gets pitched outside, but Ray yanks Hammer back inside and they go to work on him, mixing in double teams. Jacques gets a sunset flip for what feels like a six count, but it's only two. Jacques keeps the pressure on Hammer and tags in Ray. They continue to tag in and out, grabbing near falls. Jacques goes to an abdominal stretch as V tries to manage from the booth. Hammer tosses Jacques off and tags Brutus, who gets a nice power slam for two. Ray comes in and turns the tide, but Brutus traps him in the corner and buries some knees. Hammer comes off the top with a clobbering blow and clubs away, keeping Ray grounded in trouble. Ray turns the tide again and tags in Jacques, leading to a double dropkick for two. Hammer shoves Jacques to the corner, lays in chops, and tags Brutus for some double teaming. Brutus works the lower body, but Jacques fights off both Dream Team members in the corner. Ray comes in, and everything breaks down, leading to the Dream Team colliding. Jacques slams Brutus in the corner. Ray heads up top and backflips onto Brutus with Jacques' help. Jacques whiffs on a dropkick that allows Hammer to make the save, and both Rougeaus get chucked to the floor. Hammer runs Ray to the edge of the ring. The Dream Team keep double-teaming Ray outside, but back inside, Beefcake works over his back with some pretty good-looking power moves. Hammer tags in and grabs a bear hug, and I thought the Dream Team worked really masterfully here, really double-teaming wherever they could, dominating the back of Ray. Ray eventually dodges a pair of Hammer elbows and escapes for the tag. Jacques cleans house with a flurry as Gorillaz is trolling Johnny V now. Jacques wipes out both guys with a dropkick but misses a splash off the top. Hammer gets the figure four, but Jacques really hangs in until Ray makes the save. Hammer tries for the figure four again, but Ray comes in with a sunset flip for the win. Johnny V's freaking out as the crowd's cheering. It was a really fun match. I thought they worked perfectly on both ends. It was great chemistry. It was fluid and well executed, and the Dream Team can still go. Beefcake has really improved, like we talked about. And the Rougeaus add some quality depth to an already strong tag division here in 1986. Those are good stuff. I went 3 stars on this, John. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, me too. Slightly less, 2.5. But, I mean, these guys are all pros. The Hammer and the Rougeaus are just masterful at tag team work. And the Dream Team was solid double teaming. And Johnny B wasn't as annoying cheering him on in this match. My favorite part was when Hammer had the figure four on Jocks and D is saying, "Ref, he gave up. He gave up in French. He gave up in French." And he was saying, "Ring the bell, ref." He's saying, "Give up in French." And he was freaking out there. But one thing that stuck up was Canada didn't really go that crazy. No wonder why they turned the Rougeaus heel and down the road, because I didn't really hear that like strong Canadian response. Maybe because they're more for in Montreal and it was a Toronto thing or something. But I didn't, or maybe it was just the way the crowd was mic'd. But they didn't really give an extra special rumpf there for the Rougeaus.
Yeah.
I gave this 3 stars as well. The one point I really want to talk about is for the first time I think since the Dream Team has been a team, this is the first time that I feel like Beefcake didn't need a lot of handholding. I almost feel like he was just as much of a dictator of pacing as Hammer was. I think Beefcake finally, I think this is where this little stretch here in late 86 where he really turns the corner and becomes a good experienced in-ring guy. And again, all that credit goes to the Hammer for working him through into, you know, late 85 and throughout 86. And he really got it. And again, I mean, it doesn't hurt to have a real good, experienced, flowing team like the Rougeaus who, you know each other in the ring and know how to work their opponents. So I think that's what made Beefcake even more impressive for me, working with a really good team, really athletic team, really high-risk team, and Beefcake didn't look lost. And he hasn't really looked lost for a while, but this was one case where it was almost like Hammer sat back and said, you know, I'd let him do a lot of the yeoman's work, and Beefcake did. Not that Valentine took like the match off. I mean, he was awesome like he always is. But Beefcake definitely felt more of a leadership role in a match for the first time in a while. Your official time, by the way, I didn't have it there. Let's see what Mr. Cawthon has. The official time is 14:51. So good, a pretty hefty match in that aspect. And I thought Beefcake looked great. I agree with you, JR. I think he definitely has gotten it figured out. Not figured out. How do I word it? The learning curve helped him.
Yeah, he's just improved.
Working with Hammer. And he's definitely experienced now. And I think he's ready for, you know, whatever happens for him in late 86 into 1987. So
we'll see. I mean, I still don't know. It's yeah, it looks like he gets it. I still don't know how much of it is that he is being carried by Hammer and put in positions to succeed. Like, we'll see when he has to carry a match on his own. But he's definitely improved in this role. But I'm slightly skeptical to say, okay, he's ready to go out on his own. Because it still could be a lot of just smoke and mirrors with Hammer setting him up in good positions to succeed.
Oh, sure. Makes sense. I could see that. But it just didn't look – he didn't look as handheld as he normally does. But I'm sure that there still needs to be some work done. But he definitely looked more independent than he had in the past. But 14:51, pretty good. Longest match of the night.
No, so. I dug it. All right, Bobby Heenan is with Gene talking with the main event. Takes a shot at the Blue Jays, choking, and then promises the world title is coming to the waist of Paul Orndorff and Hulkamania will be dead. And then that leads us to our next-to-last match on the night, and that is Pedro Morales taking on the King, Harley Race. Of course, he became King at the King of the Ring Tournament, Foxborough, Massachusetts, July 14th, 1986. The second annual King of the Ring defeated this very man, Pedro Morales, in the finals. So this is a rematch of the finals of that tournament. And when was it? You guys remember when the coronation was? I mean, was it like immediately after that, or was it... it looks like it was on the August 30th Championship Wrestling. The final ever was Championship what? Wrestling is when they have the coronation.
Yes. Yep.
But he's already King here. So was he already wearing the gear, I guess?
I guess it was taped. It was probably taped before that.
So. Yeah, it was taped August 5th, so. So it looks like he's been wearing it pretty much probably since he won the tournament. But he is the king now. All right, so with the match.
Yeah, the actual first challenge taping was the day before,
right,
in Hartford. So obviously those were all still the last challenge taping, or the last championship
wrestling one.
Tape.
Yeah, August 5th. That's the last. That was the last ever episode was August 30th. That's when Race is coronated. So, anyway, interesting matchup of veterans here late in the night. Race now fully into the King gimmick. Pedro's just lingering around fighting whoever shows up pretty much month to month. Race slugs away to start and knocks Pedro to the floor, where he follows out and batters him and runs him into the post. Pedro counters the pile driver with a backdrop, and both men head back inside. Pedro brings a fight to Race with left hands and a headbutt that sends Race to the floor. Pedro comes over to the apron, but Race catches him and starts to drop some elbows and spikes him into the timekeeper's table. Johnny V rambles about Puerto Ricans as Race drops a headbutt on him and then punches away. Pedro comes back with a suplex and then a small package for two. Pedro hammers away and dodges a charge and gets a sunset flip for a near fall. Pedro comes at Harley in the corner. Harley trips him up and pins him with his feet on the ropes to steal the win. I fucking hate that finish, but I guess we should just be happy that Pedro actually fucking laid down. Since we know he needs to be protected at all times. The crowd chants bullshit as Harley celebrates. This was decent, thanks to Harley. The brawling on the floor was fine. He was carrying it. Harley deserves a little bit better. I went a star on this one between these two guys. Again, decent brawl, but it just the end is just so... I'm done with Pedro. I'm really done with Pedro. Scott, talk about the match, and then tell me what you think about giving Race the King gimmick.
The match was, as good as it was going to be. I gave it a star and a half. I'm sure it probably would have been better when they were both champions in like 1970. Well, I guess by the time, let's see, he lost the belt in 73. And I don't think, well, Harley, I guess, won his first belt around then before losing to Jack Briscoe. So let's say late 70s. I'm sure a match in like even 78 probably would not have been as good, would have been a lot better than this. I think giving Harley Race the King gimmick was tremendous. I think it was a backhanded respect thing. Like, I can't call you the NWA, seven-time NWA, world heavyweight champion, but I'll make you the King. I'll give you cool tights, purple tights, crown on your butt, carry around a crown, wear the thing, I think the gimmick was kind of a backhanded compliment to Harley at his career without being able to acknowledge that the guy is one of the greatest of all time. So I had no problem with the King. I thought it was great. That was fantastic. And it worked for Harley because he had that regal kind of pompous, grizzled, arrogant look to him anyway. And it was better than those ridiculous red, white, and blue or the barbershop tights he had on, whatever the hell those terrible tights he had on were. So at least he'll start settling into better-looking ring gear. And this match is – I know we were on the big Pedro kick on the last show with him and Savage, but obviously that was lightning in a bottle. That was like one last dip into the fountain of youth. Pedro just can't keep up with the talent anymore, so probably should be phased out. But Harley's awesome. I think the King gimmick's perfect for him. Having said that, again, I gave this a star and a half. And your official runtime is – oh, I didn't write it down there. Actually, I don't even think Graham has a runtime for it. Let me see. It wasn't long. What did you think? It was probably 5 minutes.
Not even. I don't think it was even that.
Yeah. Let's see. Harley Race. Yeah, even Graham doesn't have a time. I bet you it was like 4.5 minutes probably.
Yeah, something like that.
So, yeah, I give it a star and a half, and I love Harley and the King gimmick. What do you think, John?
Yeah, one star. I mean, listening to the vaults where with Pedro matches, I'm like, damn, these guys are kind of hard on Pedro. But having to analyze one of his matches, all he has is that lefty punch where he slaps his fist and that's it. I'm like, what other move does he have? He's got a good lefty punch, and that's about it. And there's really not much to Pedro. So all that criticism is kind of warranted. And Johnny was the worst during this match. He was terribly annoying. He was just going on. He was like ranting something ridiculous. Like, oh, Pedro yells like a Puerto Rican lion, and he was just imitating like a lion. It wasn't even funny anymore.
It was too long of a show for Johnny V. He was out of gas.
Yeah. Nah. Like I said, his jokes are maybe like one out of five, his one liners, and he was losing it here. One-star special.
And Ladd is pretty much shut up. I mean, we don't even hear from him. He's gone.
Ernie gave up, man. Ernie gave up.
He's gone. We'll talk about him again more a little bit, but he's. I mean, you don't hear anything. All right, so that brings us to our main event. And, of course, that is Hulk Hogan defending the World Wrestling Federation Championship title against Paul Orndorff, the man who stabbed him in the back a couple months ago. Orndorff, of course, reunited with Bobby Heenan, has been chasing Hogan around the country wearing Hulkamania t-shirts, entering to Real American, which he does here. And I thought it was funny because it's just playing and it just keeps playing when Hogan comes out. Like, it doesn't stop and restart. They just keep coming out. Long night here. Orndorff and Heenan are showered with booze. Hogan just power walks to the ring amidst a sea of security and hands from the fans. And I thought this was maybe the highlight of the night. Just an epic entrance for Hogan. The crowd is just buzzing. The air horns are blaring. The atmosphere is just insane. And, you know, maybe I'm wrong about the crowd not being mic'd because you can fucking hear them loud and loud and clear during this match. It is super, super fired up. And that long, high shot of Hogan power walking down the aisle with all the fans reaching over and the security just surrounding him, I thought was really, really cool. Made him just look like the biggest star in the world. So, again, a great idea to get this on the big stage. And it's shrewd that they did it right after the heel turn because you're fully taking advantage of the peak heat of Paul Orndorff. You're not waiting for it to dissipate and making it the blow. You are, like, he is as hot as can be. And boom, we're right here in front of 65,000 people or whatever it is. I thought that was a really smart move. Orndorff decks Hogan before the bell and hammers away aggressively until Hogan turns him over and loads right hands at crisp pace. The ref pulls him apart, but the brawl reignites with a big slugfest that ends with Orndorff bailing to the floor. Paul tries to get back in, but Hogan clobbers him back out, and the challenger yanks Hogan outside and punches away. Hogan turns things around and spikes him to the apron. Back inside, Hogan cuts down Orndorff with a clothesline and then drops an elbow. Orndorff is rattled, but able to land a desperation shot to the gut. Heenan is distracted, but Hogan distracts Hogan, but the champ caught Orndorff trying to sneak attack him, and he hits him with an atomic drop. Hogan slides outside and chases Heenan around, and that allows Orndorff to grab control and go to work on the neck and back before slugging the champ to the floor. Orndorff met him out there and suplexed him hard on the mats. Orndorff keeps the pressure on with kicks and elbows in and out of the ring, and the crowd tries to rally the champ as Orndorff keeps hammering away at the chest and neck. Orndorff grabs a near fall, follows that up with a slam and a hard elbow drop to the throat for two. Orndorff's feeling good and loads up the pile driver, but Hogan backdrops out of it, and the challenger stays in control with aggressive clawing and biting at the face. Orndorff follows with a back suplex and gets a lazy cover that allows Hogan to get his foot on the ropes. As Orndorff bitches the ref, Hogan fires up and rams a knee to Paul's back, wiping out the referee. Hogan pulls Orndorff up and levels him with a clothesline as payback and then mocks Orndorff's celebration. And then he loads up a pile driver, but Heenan comes in and decks him with a chair. Orndorff covers, but the ref takes so long to crawl as time ticks away and the ref arrives, but just taps Orndorff on the shoulder. Orndorff gets up and celebrates with Bobby and then the title until Fink informs us that Heenan and Orndorff are DQ'd and Hogan has won the match. Orndorff snaps after the announcement and puts the boots to Hogan until Hulkster fights him off and sends him fleeing. I thought it was a fine finish. This feud has to keep simmering. They can't end it here. You have to keep Paul's heat there. So that's the one downside about doing a match this big this quickly is they can't blow it off. But really good match, loads of crowd heat, and it lived up to the build. Both guys busted their asses and kept the pace, and both are really aggressive to hammer everything home. Orndorff has skyrocketed up the heel side and is a perfect foil for Hogan. He's believable, the angle's great, and the crowd helped a ton. I really like the chair tease, too. I thought that was a good false finish. A strong ending to what has been a pretty shaky show. So I went 3 stars in this, John.
Yeah, me too. I went 3-2. And like you said, we were wondering about the crowd all night, whether it was mic'd properly or not. But after hearing this, this is what they were saving it for this match because they were on another level during this match. It's not even comparable to the rest of the card. The heat was just ballistic. So it definitely wasn't anything to do with the sound or anything because they came through loud and clear here. They were just including a lot of people cheering for Orndorff when he had the advantage. There are a lot of Orndorff fans here, which was good. And just Hogan just played it masterfully when he did the callback to when Orndorff turned on him.
Yeah, that was really cool.
With the clothesline and setup. That was so brilliant.
And he tried to do it earlier, like at first, and it didn't really get caught. And then all of a sudden, like he just did it too soon. Like, but once he did it after the clothesline, it was when it really made it count.
But it's exactly what you said. I was checking the history of the WWE. I believe this is only like the third match since the turn. There was one in Minnesota where Orndorff won by DQ, and the second one was in the dilapidated crack house known as the Providence Civic Center. That was with the second one, and Orndorff also won that one by DQ. So he has a like you said, they had to do the go with the finish they had because these guys are going to be going at it for a long, long extended run, and there's a lot more money to be made. So there couldn't be a solid finish here. So they did the best of what they had to work with here, as far as the finish was concerned, and the crowd went home happy anyway. But it was a sight to see Orndorff walk around with the belt for a while. That was a sight, because it's very rare where you see somebody besides Hogan kind of holding that belt during this time. So that was quite something to see.
What do you think, Scott?
Yeah, I gave this 3 stars as well. This match was tremendous, and there's two guys who knew that this feud was nuclear and did every, like you said, JR. They were that's actually a great adjective. They were very aggressive. And they were really punching and kicking hard, and I bet you they worked that out. Hey, we really got to put this feud over particularly in front of this gigantic crowd. So the false finish was good, and I agree with you, John. The visual, even though it wasn't, like it didn't really happen, but the visual of somebody else wearing the belt was actually kind of neat. Yeah. It actually made the belt look big because obviously Hogan's 300 pounds, and the belt on him looked normal size, but the belt on Orndorff looked like fucking gigantic. So it was very cool to see somebody else wearing it, even though it wasn't legit. The feud definitely is not over. I think it was booked perfectly. Again, JR, if you are in the venue, you do kind of feel gypped because you thought Hogan would win clean.
Right.
As a matter of fact, the next night is the Sam Mushnick tournament, the Memorial Tournament in St. Louis, and they actually wrestle again. So they were not done.
It definitely picks up from here.
Yeah, and we'll talk. I'm sure we'll talk a lot about it over the incoming MSG house shows. I'm sure they saunter through at some point in these next few months, and I'm sure we'll see it on Sir Anthony's event as well. So, the announcing didn't hurt the match. Thank God, it was one match. By the way, your official time was 11:05. The substandard announcing didn't hurt the match. Like it did some of the other matches on this card. This match was just too good. Even lousy announcing didn't hurt it. So, 3 stars and a great finish to the show. You were gonna say something, John?
Yeah, unfortunately, I think you just get that the cage match. I think down the line, not to spoil things down the line. Because believe it or not, they detoured to my home office. They went to the Coliseum a couple times, and they never had a singles at MSG. Which
MSG,
was,
oh, bummer.
Yeah, which it was hard to believe, but they had two at Nassau. I went to the first one, and then they followed up with a cage, which I wasn't able to make.
Nice.
Yeah, unfortunately, yep. They don't make it to MSG. So. Not to spoil things down the line.
They wrestled the next night in the big Sam Mushnick tournament in St. Louis the next night. So, all right, JR.
Of course, you can hear more about this match and feud on Jeff Learns Wrestling. I don't think it was the last episode. It was the one before that, so be sure to check that out. So we're right around the same period on that show, too. So if you want to hear the thoughts of a new fan that never saw any of this stuff and didn't even know who Paul Orndorff was until about 3 weeks ago, be sure to check it out. All right, it's time for our awards here tonight. So we'll start, as always, what we do is with Match of the Night, and I'm really torn on this. I mean, Jake and Steamboat was really good. Probably technically the match of the night, but the atmosphere for Hogan Orndorff was so out of control and just a perfect big match feel. Hogan's entrance was unbelievable. I have to go with Hogan and Orndorff for my match of the night.
No, it definitely was. Although the Jake and Steamboat come pretty close, but the main event really did it.
What'd you have, John?
Yeah, definitely. The crowd brings it over to the top. With Jake and Steamboat, a close second, definitely.
All right, our worst match of the night, the Cousin Junior Award. I went with JYD and Adonis. Not as bad, probably, technically, as RCD and Gurria, but that was always meant to be a squash, and the expectations were trash. This you expect a little bit more, and just ended up being such a sloppy disaster. And I feel like we're saying this a lot about Adonis lately, so I don't know what's going on, but he's just not getting much help from people. But I thought this was the most disappointing worst match of the night.
I'm going to agree with you. As much as I want to destroy that RCD match, you're right. The expectations were just don't fucking die in the ring from a heart attack. JYD just fucking blew it. He totally threw in the towel on this match. It should have been a lot better. I definitely agree with you on that. I'll go with this match, too.
What do you think, John?
I think Adonis' bumping brings it a notch over RCD Gurria. like I said after the match, I just I'm still trying to figure out what Gurria was trying to do when he jumped right into him. I got to go with RCD.
He's Gurria trying to get the fuck home. That's what he was trying to do.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right, our MVP of the night, that is of course the highlight, the best guy of the show, and I went with hang on, I had it here in front of me for a second ago. Hulk Hogan, obviously, and Orndorff. I gave it to both of them. I thought they were both excellent. I thought they played their roles perfectly. Again, the match was a match of the night. The crowd was great. I think it's an easy choice for me. Hogan.
Yeah. I mean, that entire last segment of the show put it and over Orndorff, the top, considering. Yeah. I mean, that whole last segment, both of them, and putting over the main event on a show that had its ups and downs. I definitely go with both of them. I co-main events for them.
I'm going to go triple. I'm going to throw Heenan in there, too. He was great in the promo before the match.
Yep.
And then
like I said, everybody in the segment.
All three.
Yeah, everybody in the segment for me. Yep.
Yeah, that moment of the night when Hulk reenacted the turn, that was just brilliant. I mean, this is one of the greatest, most iconic turns in wrestling history, all territories included. And Hulk just pulled it off brilliantly. How he and then he just brought it right to the edge where he almost got the payoff. And you know, of course, they have to make money down the road, and they couldn't pay it off. But it was just expertly done.
Agreed. All right, let's take a look at our Uncle Elmer, the worst work of the night, and I think we can all comfortably say Ted Arcidi wins this one.
Indeed.
No, I'm going Gurria, man.
Gurria? All right.
I'm going Gurria.
John, what could he have even done? I mean, there's very small room for error there. Could have really blown.
Brian Bayless sheds a tear. Arcidi is getting close. He's won now three times, but I think it's the last we see him. So we'll have to debate. We'll have to talk to Kelly when he returns if he should supersede Uncle Elmer for the worst worker of the night. Best moment of the night, I'm going back to Hogan again, and it was his entrance. Hogan's entrance to me was the highlight. It was an awesome moment. The crowd was insane. Just that visual, just the biggest star in the world right now.
Oh, I don't think there's any doubt. He's owning the place. He's the face that runs the place, to steal something from modern day. He's the man. There's no doubt.
Yeah, I don't want to be repetitive, but the best one was when he reenacted the turn on Orndorff, and when he did, you know, when he did the clothesline and had him up for the pile driver. That was the best moment.
Mm.
Okay. All right, and our Junior Mr. Universe Award for the most juiced, I think Ted Arcidi for that one, at least. We all in agreement.
No, I think John,
Tony
I think John likes
Tony,
I think John
Gurria for that
Gurria
one.
For that.
All right,
Arcidi all the way.
So it's pretty much Hogan, Orndorff, and Arcidi win the night for Gurria. Those four almost swept all the categories for us tonight. So it tells you there's not much variance in the show. So for an overall grade, I went back and forth on this one because it was trending for a while to be pretty low. But the main event's really good. The Bees match, I mean, the Rougeau's match is really good, and Steamboat Jake's really good. So we kind of finished strong. The commentary settles in a bit. I went 4 out of 10, which isn't terrible. I mean, I gave WrestleMania 2 a 4.5. I'd say this is probably a slight bump below that. So I feel comfortable putting it there. For the Wrestling Classic, I went with a 4. So, I think it's on par with that. Same kind of structure to the card. So that's where I'm at on this one. Scott, what do you have?
I'm going to give it a 5 because I think it's right down the middle. I mean, three-star matches, a couple of duds, which the announcing just as bad as WrestleMania 2, I suppose, in some ways. But I think it's right down the middle. I think it's not great, but it didn't suck. And, you know, we did give, I mean, three-star matches is nothing to sneeze at. Mm-hmm. And they were really good matches. So I'm going to give it right down the middle and give it a 5 out of 10. I couldn't go higher than that. Even as great as the main event was, Jake and Steamboat was really, really good. I can't go higher than 5. But I'll go right down the middle, 5 out of 10.
All right, John?
Yeah, it's funny. I split the difference, 4.5. Okay. So the crowd visuals and those moments with Jake Steamboat and Hogan Orndorff bring it up. But there was a lot of direct, though, to bring it down, including the commentary, which brings it down a notch. But, I'll go 4.5.
And we'll talk more about the commentary here because we're going to read some feedback that was posted at PlaySummation.com. If you want to get feedback each and every show, you can do it at PlaySummation.com. We'll read it at the end of the show. And there's some good ones here, and we do focus on the commentary in a moment, too. From our buddy Bruins 309, the big event is a show that was crying out for Jesse Ventura on commentary. He was close to his return. The dullness of many of these matches may have been helped with him and his quips. not a show I've gone back and watched in a few years. Our pal Greg Phillips says, I remember being underwhelmed by Jake and Steamboat, although the crowd was pretty awesome in terms of his size at the time. Well, Greg, I think you should rewatch Jake and Steamboat. You may be whelmed instead of underwhelmed. Greg Dufour checks in for the first of a few times. Oh, dear God, the big event. Did you notice how Ernie Ladd just vanishes from commentary? The worst I've heard on one of these shows I've ever seen. The best part is they show a view from the commentary booth, and Ladd is sitting there with his arms crossed, just pouting, almost like someone just told him to stop talking. Bruins responds to him, saying, Ladd did the first set of challenge tapings the day before the big event and then was gone, so maybe he was actually canned during the event or knew, you know, I'm adding this, maybe he knew it was his last show and he said, fuck it, I'm not dealing with this shit anymore. Dufour said he should have been canned after that performance so bad during the opening match. And, I mean, do you guys think there's some validity? I don't think he was fired on the show, but it wouldn't surprise me if he had, you know, already known that this was going to be his last contracted event and just kind of mailed it in. And then as V was going off the rails and Gorilla, he just said, fuck it. Or do you think they fired him as a result?
I don't think Ernie was that bad. It was just that he didn't fit with those two arguing knuckleheads. I mean, he was a little too technical, a little dry, but I don't think he was that terrible.
No, I think putting Johnny V here was the mistake. It should have just been Gorilla and Ernie, honestly.
Well, I liked Ladd a lot on that MSG show that we watched. I mean, that was pretty good.
But I think if we're looking for legit, this was a bigger show that needed to be where the matches needed to be focused on more instead of Johnny V working on his next show at Caroline's. I think Gorilla and Ernie alone, I think, would have been
or
a
even Al.
Combo.
I mean, they could have just done Gorilla, Alan, and Ernie. You know what I mean? Like that would have been fine too.
Mm-hmm.
All right,
We don't see Al anywhere. Very strange.
Yeah, he's off tonight. All right, one more question from this. Is actually, a question from Greg. Do you think the Moondogs should have been gotten a bigger push in 85, 86? I thought they were awesome in the early 80s when it was Spot and Rex and their feud against Martel and Gurria, and always put on solid matches. They put it with Jimmy Hart for a while, but never did anything with them. I know Brian Bayless had commented that the tag division was so deep, especially on the heel side, they probably wouldn't have ever really gotten much of a chance. And, you know, Greg, like, I think they were really good, and I could see the thought to give them a bigger push, but I almost think they were more valuable in the role they were in. Because we've talked about it show after show, saying, like, oh, Spot made this guy look good. Rex really made this guy look good. Like, having them work in that gatekeeper role as guys move up into the mid-card really helped these guys look better than maybe they even were, or at least get them on their feet by putting on a strong performance because they knew how to work and put together a match. So I think they were actually probably more valuable in the role they were in than any kind of sustained push. Now, could they have had a little bit of a, you know, feud with like the Bulldogs or something? Possibly, but I don't know. I kind of like the slot they were in. I think they were really effective in it. What'd you guys think?
It goes back to what you said earlier. They kind of had to trim the fat and kind of push some of the older guys aside and make way for new blood. So I think the Moondogs had that time. And just
but
like
even,
I said,
how about even off, before this?
Better off as a drop of, yeah, drop it to a stars. Sure.
I thought Rex was hurt, and that's why we had so much spotty solo stuff. Because I feel like the reason we didn't see a lot of Moondogs was because we only saw Spotty. Spotty wrestled a lot, but we didn't really see a lot of Rex. I thought maybe he was hurt, to be honest with you. So maybe that's why. Because we haven't seen Rex on hardly any of our shows, JR. And I was watching some Boston Garden 86, and maybe occasionally he would do a singles match, but he didn't look like he was around a lot. So maybe he was hurt. Maybe that's why they didn't really push him.
Could have Spot and King.
Yes. Or Cousin Luke. Why not bring him in?
Oh, God.
Let's see. Rex. He's working all through March, May. Worked all through May, June. I mean, maybe missed a blip in April, looks like. But now he's been there pretty much consistently.
All right. So it's weird, though, because Spotty did so much solo stuff. So.
Well, he didn't wrestle until March in 86, so maybe he was hurt in the beginning of the year. I guess it's possible.
Because Spotty's on a lot, both on, you know, TV tapings, either solo or even teaming with some other schlub.
Let's see, Rex does a lot in January and February 85, but let me check the end of the year and see if maybe he was hurt at the end of the year into 86. Let's see. He's actually done. He wrestles January, February, early March, and then he's done for all of 85. So I guess there's a chance that maybe he was hurt throughout 85 and into early 86.
That's what I'm thinking. Because it's not like they didn't do anything. Spotty seemed to be all over the place. Tapings and house shows. He was definitely working. Spotty was.
Yeah, no, he's all on his own. Moondog Spot is Russell solo pretty much the rest of 85. So when was King around, D'Amato? Was that before this?
Yeah. That was like 84-ish.
Yeah, King was gone a while.
Yeah, Spot works pretty much solo all of it. So maybe Rex was hurt for most of 85 then, or he left and then came back. Either way. All right, thanks for the feedback, everyone. Be sure to get that in each every week, and we will definitely continue to read it on air. All right, that wraps things up. Hopefully everyone enjoyed. Be sure, of course, to participate in the PTBN Greatest WWE Wrestler Ever Project. You can join that on Facebook or get in the conversation at PlayStation.com, where the comments are open. You can join the conversation each and every day. Shop with us at PlayStation.com/Amazon. Facebook.com/PlaceToBeNation, Twitter, place number 2BNation. As you heard, a new main event dropped last week, so check that out. New letters from Kayfabe each and every Friday. That one was out this past Friday. New one this week as well. Jeff Learns Wrestling, check that out every 2 to 3 weeks or so. I think next week will be the next episode, and we're going to look at the entire WrestleMania 3 card, which Jeff has never seen. So it'll be really fun to get his take on that. As always, D'Amato, anything you want to cover? You good?
I'm good, thanks.
All right, very good. Scott, anything besides main event you got?
No, pretty good for the moment. Looking forward to next week. And, next week we will do the next main event and preview SummerSlam and everything else. But, definitely please hop in. Go to our chats. We're going to do another live watch this week.
We did one last night. Yeah, we're going to try and do one every Sunday. So any non-pay-per-view Sunday. So last night we did SummerSlam 97. There's a poll in the live chats group on Facebook to vote right now for the show that we want to watch next Sunday night.
I'm torn. So, I haven't voted yet.
Well, what are the options?
Really,
we have
SummerSlam
89,
05, and 11.
No, it's 89, 02, 05, and 92. That's what.
And 92, yeah. I'm sorry. 92.
So 89 is winning right now by a decent clip. So if you want to get in on the vote or at least be part of the conversation next Sunday night, join us or stay tuned for details at PlayStation.com for that. So, all right, let's wrap up. We'll be back next week. Kelly will be back with us. We'll be looking at the 9/22/86 MSG House Show. And the week after that, we have some Saturday Night's Main Event returns after its summer hiatus. So, for Mr. D'Amato, thanks for joining us. We'll talk to you soon, probably back for WrestleMania 3. We'll see. Scott?
Sure.
That's that. We're out. Talk to you. It's Christmas! It's